Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is a TWiT Live special, Photo Day with Chris Marquardt, TWiT Live special number 135. Hi, I'm Leo Laporte. Welcome to something we've done now 3 years in a row. We've given Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, the floor, and he's taken over for hours and hours. We call it Photo Day, and it's great to have you back.
Which is awesome. I totally appreciate having the chance to do this. Coming here, being on the show with you on the Tech Guy Show every Sunday is very awesome, and then being here and just kind of taking over. I'll kick you out in a short while.
Yeah, but I'm just going to stick around for a little bit.
We have more guests coming up. We are looking at photography outside the mainstream. That's the theme for today. So we will talk to someone who flies kites and hangs cameras off them. We'll talk to someone who does 1850s photo technology. So that is clearly outside the mainstream. We will have some travel photographers on who are absolutely, they travel pretty much everywhere you can think, and they have stories to tell you wouldn't believe.
So, well, I will leave my laptop here so that you can show the pictures from these various people, because we'll need a way to do that, right?
I have a laptop here, too.
Oh, good. All right.
That one up. And we'll have short breaks in between where I'm going to answer listener questions. So if you are on the chat or if you are on Twitter, I will be looking for the Twitter hashtag PhotoDay2012. And in the breaks when we set up for new guests, I'm going to take questions.
Great. So I think we're all set.
Let's kick this off with the first part, which is, well, you know, you might have seen one of these here. I'm not sure. Is it showing? Yeah, it is.
This is a lens I covet deeply.
This is, here we go. Okay, so.
So this goes with your, you have a Canon 5D Mark II.
3 years old, beaten up. Same as this lens. You can see, like, it's got dings and stuff everywhere. I bought this used from an architectural photographer.
This is, now Canon makes a couple of tilt shift lenses.
And that is one of them.
And this is a 24 millimeter.
It's a 24 millimeter prime lens. It is not a zoom. Yep. It is even manual focus. Not autofocus.
It is an L lens. I see the red ring on it. So it is one of their better lenses. And it should be because it's, what, $3,000 or $4,000 new.
New, this one costs, I think, around $2,000.
That's nothing.
I did not buy this new. I bought this used from an architectural photographer for $500. Something like that. I was lucky.
And it is typically, they are used by, yeah, it's $1,999.
You're right. The new ones, there is like the new model of these lenses, they go for $2,200, $2,400, something along those lines. So then definitely not your everyday lens. But there are two cool things about these. And one is they let you, well, it's a tilt shift lens. So first of all, it tilts, and you can see that here. It tilts the,
So
here we go. So it tilts the angle.
We've probably all seen tilt shift simulated. You know, Instagram has simulated tilt shift.
So
a lot
here,
of apps do.
This is how we do
where
this.
Some stuff's in focus and some stuff's in out of focus.
Right. What this does is it tilts the focal plane. So what you have is in front of your camera, you have parallel to the camera, you have this focal plane. This is the area where the picture is in focus, where it's sharp. And by tilting this lens to the side, you get to tilt the focal plane. So all of a sudden, you can have stuff in focus. Let's say you shoot a landscape. You have this tilted forward. Let's just do that here. So it's pretty much now tilted downwards. So you point it at a landscape. It's tilted forward, and you have the focal plane now all of a sudden where the ground is. Now, you know where
the... So the idea that you said architectural photography used this. One way that you can use this is so that if you take a picture of a building and you're standing at the bottom of the building and you're shooting up...
This is the second part.
Okay.
The tilt has nothing to do with that. The tilt just tilts the focal plane and you get the sharpest in different areas of the photo. But
so that's the stuff that we've seen the tilt shift filters do.
Exactly.
Where, and it makes things look like toys.
There's a tilt filters.
It's a weird, so they're not doing the shift. They're just doing the tilt.
Exactly.
Oh, how interesting. So it's a weird effect because, like, if you're at the top of a building and you take a picture of a city and the cars are little and stuff, and you use the tilt on that.
You tilt that focal plane so that it looks a bit like a macro photo with very shallow depth of field. Just a very little thing. And your brain goes, oh, there's just a little bit in focus. It must be a macro photo. Everything must be very small. Ah. So it's a psychological thing. Your brain goes, ooh, it looks like a macro. And it does it matches that to whatever it has seen before.
Got it.
And then all of a sudden, you perceive that as being a macro shot. So everything has to be small, right? And what these tilt shift, if you use it as that effect, what they typically then also do is they crank up the color saturation, make a bit of a toyscape, you know?
Yeah. It looks like it's a Fisher-Price village, except it's real.
Exactly.
It's a neat effect.
That is the tilt. But now let's look at the shift, because that is, I think, more important or more.
Here's a shot. This is from Wikipedia of a football game. That's a good example. So this is a real game, but something about the way that this, the borders are out of focus makes the eye think these are little miniatures, not real.
And look at the cranked up contrasts here.
Yeah, the saturation.
The saturation is very. Yep. So it really looks like a toy. Toy landscape.
But that's only one use for a tilt shift.
That's one.
By the way, I have a lens baby, which is kind of a crappy
form. It's a poor man's tilt
shift. It's a poor man's tilt shift, but they're not very expensive. It's not a very good lens. It's probably a plastic lens. But
no,
it does,
it's glass, but it's...
It's not a high-quality optics. But it fits my camera, and I can do these... It has the adjustments.
You know,
kind of weird adjustments.
Who likes lens babies?
Who does?
Wedding photographers. Because you get this dreamy look where you have some part in focus and the rest around it is out of focus. And,
yeah. But the optics aren't as good as this lens.
No, they aren't.
Yeah.
Now, the second part, and that is kind of where the architectural photographers come in, is the shifting. So what you can do is you can shift this lens. Let me get this reflection right. Here we go. You can shift this up and down. Now, what happens is that you move that whole picture up and down. So imagine you stand in front of a tall building. You want to get the whole building in the shot. What you would typically do is you would tilt the camera back. So you would point it at the camera and then tilt it back.
But then it looks like the building's looming over. It looks like it's almost about to fall over on top of you.
Well, then all
you.
The parallel lines in the building
right.
and all of a sudden
converge
to the top. So you have this feeling like it's the building's falling backwards.
Right.
What you can do by shifting this up and down is that you end up with the lines still parallel, but you have the whole building. So you can stand in front of a building, get the whole building in the shot with all the lines very parallel, and that is a very, very amazing-looking effect because it gives it this whole thing a lot more... It looks much more professional.
It's like you're standing on the ground shooting this thing shooting up, but it was as if you got up on a cherry picker, a tall ladder, and you were shooting it straight on.
Yes.
But can you not do both of these effects in Photoshop?
You can do both, but what happens is not really the tilt effect.
Yeah.
You can just
can undistort the building.
You can undistort the building, but then Photoshop will start inventing pixels because it'll have...
It has to fill it in.
It's the interpolation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then and with simulating the tilt-shift effect only goes one way but not the other way. And what you can't get is... Just imagine the tilt-shift would coincide with this table. So the focal plane would be on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the unsharpness? It's under the table and over the table.
Right.
So this would be out of focus.
Right.
And down here...
Only something on the
focus.
Table would be perfectly focused.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you have like a landscape and you have trees sticking out and they go slightly out of focus on the top, you cannot really simulate that with a computer.
So you spend $2,000, get a fancy lens.
Or get one used. But the interesting thing is now, where does this come from? Why... Are photographers still using these kind of things?
Right. Where did they first learn about it?
And this takes us back to... let me do a bit of show and tell here.
Yeah, I think so. Because you brought a really fun toy here.
I brought you something.
This is a modern version of a classic camera.
It is pretty much... the tilt shift as how it used to be. Because photography used to be exactly... To do exactly this or to be able to do exactly this. And
look at that. There's
unfold,
the bellows.
Let's unfold this.
How many times have we seen those old westerns where you got the guy with the... He puts his head under a cloth And he's got a flash, and he says, smile at the birdie. And he's got this big bellows camera. That's what this is. It's called a view camera, right?
It's a view camera. It's more of a field camera because you can take it in the field.
This is beautifully made. This is obviously modern. This is not an antique.
This is actually new, yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Pretty much new.
So people are still making these.
They are still making these. And let me take this thing off the back. So
now, this uses film.
And it is a camera that does... it's pretty much a camera as any other camera. It's a box that is light tight.
Right. So the lens is up front.
Right.
This is the capture plane here.
In the back, there's a focusing screen. Mm-hmm. You have one of these in your DSLR. It's just much smaller and it's angled because it's the light comes in over a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the front, you want to put a lens. So let me just.
And it's using Nikkor lenses, so it has a Nikon mount.
It has a
little plane that you just can screw a lens into.
It has a lens plate.
Oh, how interesting.
There's a different one. So this is a Schneider Kreuznach.
Oh,
made.
Yeah.
There are lots of.
So you'll get a plate that's appropriate to the mount that you want to use.
Exactly.
So you can put any lens on the front. That's nice, too. Really great.
It's not as much a system as you'd have with a DSLR.
But everything that you do with this is much more kind of thoughtful and
you have to
stately.
It forces you to do that.
You've got spirit levels on the top, on the sides,
right?
So you can level this thing.
So
usually you'd use this on a tripod. You don't handhold anything like this.
You would use this on a tripod. Yeah. You would set it up so it's parallel to the buildings, and then
where you could do the tilt shift effect because
exactly
this can
the same stuff.
This can be angled
here. Shift. Shift.
You're shifting it up.
Down.
Shifting it down.
You get to.
And you can also shift it this way.
Move this in. So you get to, here we go. You get to.
Oh, look at that.
Tilt this pretty much any way you like.
This is made by Chamonix.
This is a Chinese product, actually.
Okay.
The name doesn't suggest that.
No, it sounds French.
So you get to even.
Are these expensive?
The cameras like these are in the $1,000. So
I mean, it's beautiful. It actually is beautifully machined. This is nice wood. I mean, it looks like a beautiful thing. And then now, but where do I take the picture and how do I take the picture?
Well, first of all, what you want to do is you will open the lens. You do pretty much what your DSLR does for you automatically, but you do it all every single step by step. So you end up opening the lens
by hand. You set the aperture.
So here you open it by hand. So light comes through.
Yeah.
And now you focus. You look here, and then you get to.
So you do this looking through here before you put any film on it, obviously.
Exactly. You look through that, and then you see you turn this, and.
So wait a minute. Is that a shutter release that you just pressed?
That is a thing to open the shutter.
It just opened. It's not the shutter release.
It's not the release.
Okay.
You open this. You do.
You have to have it open so you can focus it and compose it.
Exactly. Okay. And then
when you close it, I presume.
Well, you set everything up. Actually, here's a cloth. There is a cloth, and this cloth goes over the back because.
Why do you need a cloth?
Because
you don't want light leaking in from the back.
The picture on the focusing screen can be kind of dark.
Okay.
Especially when you go wide angle.
Right.
So it helps you in the sun to shield.
This is so cool.
Light.
This is so old fashioned.
But it's a brand new camera.
Yeah.
So
now, but where does the film go?
Well,
is it a film camera?
First of all, let me show you the film because
when
we are talking full frame on a DSLR, 35 millimeter,
right?
Full frame suggests like big and important,
right?
Actually, the German term for the full frame
is big and important.
This is where it comes from. No, the German word for this Kleinbild, which translates to small picture, because this is the size of the negative that you used.
So this looks like a postcard. This is like what is it, 5x4?
It's 5x4, 4x5 inches.
4x5 inches.
Yeah. And.
Wow. So the negatives, and this looks like a positive.
This is a slide. Yeah. Here's just handle them. These you can handle.
So this is the actual film itself.
This is the actual.
Now obviously you can't let any light hit this.
You can't. So what you do is you put this film into.
It goes into a cartridge.
Into a cartridge.
Here, let's push this forward so you can see
that. Let's do this. So here.
And you'll do this in a dark room, right? I mean, you don't do this in the broad daylight.
Actually, you have what's called a changing bag. So it's
you do it in a bag.
It's a dark bag. Yeah. You have holes to stick the hand in.
Right.
And then you open this.
And you'll slide the film?
You slide the film in here, like this.
All of this in pitch black. You have to do it by touch.
Which is easy.
Yeah.
It's actually fairly easy. And then you close this, and now it's loaded.
And
you have a second one
on
the
sealed.
Other side.
So you get two shots. Okay.
It's light sealed, so you have two shots here.
Okay.
Now, once you finished everything, let's pull this back here. You finished everything. You set it up. You set up the aperture. Like, here's a slider. And you set up the aperture.
And one of the reasons Chris said he likes this is because it is so slow.
It makes you very conscious about all the different steps, and it really filters back into digital photography.
Yeah.
I learned my digital photography has dramatically improved since I've been going back to it doesn't have to be large format. I mean, this is
probably
overkill
like
for most
though.
People.
Where do you get the film? Do people still make this?
Oh, you can still buy film.
Yeah.
You can still B&H Photo or other places. They still have film.
Especially
negative
large
film,
format because that's, you know, you couldn't afford a digital camera with a 5x4 sensor. It would be ridiculous.
There are, as far as I know, only like a handful of these sensors out there. And those are prototype stuff. So you can't go to the shop and buy them. There are scanning backs that have a little scanner built in. So it goes...
So you can get a digital back for this, but it doesn't take the shot. It scans it.
Scans it. So if you have motion in front of the camera, you'll get funny results, like sausage-shaped cars and stuff, you know.
Now, what kind of film do you like? What do you use for this?
Oh, I shoot everything from slide film.
Fuji film?
Fuji still makes good slide film. Fuji Provia is a good film.
Provia is very nice.
I'm still totally in love
Ilford?
With
it. Is they still around?
Ilford is still HP 5 Plus, for example. Mm-hmm. You get... In this format, Tri-X from Kodak.
Kodak's still making film.
They are still making film. Actually, as far as I know, the film business is actually the most profitable business.
It is. That's one of the reasons Kodak is having troubles because nobody's buying film, and they wish you would.
So
it's interesting because I used to use a changing bag, to roll my own Tri-X.
So you bought
into
it in
35mm
spools,
rolls.
And bigger
you buy
reels,
a big spool. And that was the way you got the shots down to a penny a picture.
Yes.
Because you develop it yourself as well. Mm-hmm. And it was in the old days, if you were shooting film, the only way you could economically shoot film and get the kind of learning cycle that we get now automatically with digital. But this is taking it way back.
So,
I mean, we haven't even taken a picture yet, folks.
No, we haven't taken the picture yet. So
we're not even ready to take the picture yet.
The next thing we do is we meter exposure. So you need a light meter.
You need a light meter.
That's
for
what
this.
Your camera does All for right. you. In this case... There are iPhone apps that do that.
Really? Do
very
they do it well?
Ones, very well.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not.
I'll be tickety dang. So I could use my iPhone as a light meter.
The iPhone is a very good light meter.
I had no idea.
Let me show that. So here we go. Now I get to set up what aperture I want to shoot at.
And then what app is this?
I give it the ISO of the film. Film has ISO, same as right. digital cameras have. Right. And then it tells me what shutter speed I need to use.
We used to call it ASA, but it's the same thing.
It's ISO and ASA are interchangeable. Yeah. So I have my time set up, let's say half a second.
That you got from the light meter because...
Light meter told me that.
Now, we're taking such a big size negative. A lot of light's going to get in. Does that change the size of the aperture? Because of the negative?
What you have a very different type.
You can't do the same calculations.
No, well, so you can just meter it if you have to take into account.
So what aperture? We're going to do half a second and what aperture?
Well, let's say f/22.
Okay.
The normal working aperture on those are a bit smaller than on a DSLR.
Okay.
But the picture is much bigger and you have a different depth of field in those pictures.
So f/22, which would have zero, would be completely in focus on a digital camera.
It's going to be...
There might have some depth of field on
totally,
this.
Totally, absolutely. Yeah. So we're there. We have everything metered.
So we're still going to focus carefully on this.
Close this. Now
do you have a lens cap? How do you...
No. It's close.
There's
it's
a shutter.
It's a
okay.
lever here.
Okay.
So now we cock the shutter.
You just cocked it by...
We cocked the shutter.
Now, is this a blade shutter? What kind of shutter is this?
It's a leaf shutter.
It's a leaf shutter.
It's in the lens.
And it's going to iris open and then shut
Actually,
down.
Let me show you here.
Can we take a picture?
So, we're almost there.
We're almost there, ladies almost and there. Gentlemen.
So, this is a lens.
So, this wouldn't be good for sports photography, I'm guessing.
Well, they used to have the Graflex cameras, the press cameras.
Right, sure. You'd have that big flash on
so,
it.
So, here... This is the lens.
Oh, you can kind of see it.
It has like a part on the inside. It has the part on the outside. And the thing here in between, this is the actual shutter.
Wow.
So this opens and closes it.
Do you have to use a lens designed for this kind of camera?
Yes, you have, because it has to have a big image circle. It has to cover this entire
otherwise,
negative.
You'll have this giant negative, and the shot will be a little 35 millimeters
exactly.
square.
Exactly. It has to cover the entire negative,
right.
And it also has to allow for movement. It has to allow for the tilt and the shift. Because if you shift, you move that image circle. So
right.
You want this to be bigger than the negative.
Interesting. So the image circle is larger than the negative so
right.
that you have some room to move this
and,
thing.
And that actually determines the price of the lens.
Of course it does.
The image circle,
sure.
The more expensive lens.
Expensive optics. You got a big lens.
Okay, so we're almost there.
All right. We've set the aperture.
Yes.
We've set the shutter speed. We've cocked the shutter itself. We haven't yet, but I guess the last thing we're going to do is put the film in.
We're getting there.
We use a shutter release on this, of course, because that's the guy has his head under a bag and he's got to press the...
Well, he doesn't have the head under the cloth anymore because you don't...
I like it. Web 8314 says, this is Amish photography.
This is kind of, yeah.
I like it. This is handmade photographs.
You don't have your head under the thing because you set everything
You already
up.
Did it.
It's focused. It's composed.
You could take your head out of the bag now because you've got the shot. Just don't knock it. And boy, it wouldn't be great for people who are people. You want to do still lifes.
No, a portrait photography with these is actually
very,
very
beautiful. You tell somebody to stay there, don't move?
Yes. So here we go. Now comes the film. And this is where we actually take the shot. Now let me turn this around.
The cartridge is going to go into our back here.
So back here we have this... Actually, this is pretty modular. You can take this off. So this
I have to say, this is gorgeous.
This is the back.
I love this.
Focusing screen.
Yeah.
And interestingly,
it's very aesthetic.
4x5, if you want to have this in landscape format, you just turn it 90 degrees.
Oh, how funny.
It's that easy.
Oh, how funny.
So here comes the film.
Yeah.
And you put this film in here, and it's like a spring mechanism. So you just slide this. Now the film is where the
That's it.
Focal plane was. Next step is... You pull the dark slide, so you...
We don't have to worry about light leaking in at all on this.
You don't have to worry about that
okay.
unless you take this out now.
All right.
Which...
Because you've pulled the...
You pulled the... So now in this light tight box, the film can be exposed.
Yep.
And the next thing is you press the shutter. Here you go.
Really? I'm going to take the picture here.
You're going to take the picture.
It's not real film, I hope.
No. Go.
I wonder how this is going to feel. Let me just try it here.
Oh, yeah, that was half a second.
It was chick chick, and it does feel good.
Take another one. Let me cock the shutter.
Yeah, let's take another one. I feel like I'm doing an injection here.
Yep,
that's cool.
And now you're done.
Let's do another one. I'll put my microphone over so people can hear that.
This is
kind of a neat sound. Yeah,
and this was half a second, so you can go faster or slower.
Now, you only could take one unless you... But, you know, one of the things you could do with this that's hard to do on a digital camera is multiple exposures.
Actually, this is very typical for beginning 4x5 photographers. You forget...
Accidental multiple exposures.
I'd once had a triple exposure, which was fun. So now you put the dark slide back.
But you could also do it intentionally, and that's kind of cool. You could do it in Photoshop,
exactly.
I guess, but it's fun.
And
to
now this is exposed.
That's done. Now, do you have to put that somewhere safe?
Yes, you have these little things.
You can lock it so nobody can open it up.
There is this. You see these little notches here.
Yeah.
They're not on the inside. So you turn that dark side around, so you know when the notches are
out
exposed.
So you'll know.
You'll know
after a while.
Or you put the dark side in the wrong way, and you
right.
don't know, and then you end up with a double exposure. So
and how much is this film? About a buck negative? Somebody's saying, is that right?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's pretty much it. There's more expensive one and more cheaper one, and.
Wow.
It evens out somewhere. So.
Wow.
This will take you 5 minutes maybe to set up, to get everything right. And it'll so slow you down.
Right.
That sometimes I return home with, let's say, 12 exposures.
Right.
From an entire day.
Right.
But the fun thing is, when I shoot digital, I come home with 500 exposures.
Right.
And I might have 10 really good ones. Those 12 exposures, I can almost be sure that at least 50 to 70% of those will be good.
Because you spent so much careful time thinking about it.
You were very deliberate.
Yeah.
So now, next question is, but how do you do like street photography with one of these? Well, yes, you do. To a certain extent. Here's another piece
People
of technology.
People think you're kind of, they've got Matthew Brady here.
You remember the old Graflex press cameras? They used
yeah, those are the
press
ones.
Cameras. The ones with a big flash, with a big round flash.
In Marilyn Monroe, and you go poof, and and they had a big handle.
So
on
how
it.
Would they take more than one shot?
I don't know.
Well, first of all, they They had a focusing mechanism, right. So you could focus without looking at the screen. And then they had these, and this is a Graphmatic bag. This actually holds six shots.
So they could pull out each
negative. It's a revolving kind of thing. So what you have in here, let me just open that for you. It has six different become septums that each hold a slice of film. And you put this back in here. And then what you get to do is...
You have to manually rotate it, though.
Well, what you do is you pull it out.
Yep.
Now the film is out. So this is in the camera, obviously. Right. And when you're done, you pull this out and it flops
to
the bottom.
Puts the next one in there.
Flops to the bottom, goes over it, and then the next one comes out.
That's... Well, and if next time you watch an old movie where the press photographers with the bent fedoras are taking pictures, you'll see them doing that. You'll see, I totally remember that.
And it's got a little counter on there.
So you know what you've done.
It's got a little lock on here so you can accidentally do something. So six shots in one of those. And with a press camera, you could go click, click, click. You could do a shot every 2 seconds with that.
Right.
If you work
so next step, we've got the images. We've got our little cartridge here.
Right.
Would you bring it to Costco? You bring it to Photo Plus? Where do you? How do you get that?
Well, first of all, there are
people will do this.
Professional labs out there that you can send them to. What you do is you take these out.
Do you do your own?
This is I've developed my own film. So this is what film comes in. It's pretty much like a box. And let me just open that.
There's a this is a Velvia box.
In here is another box. So it's let me show. In this box is a second box, and then it's light tight. And in here,
got it.
You would put the developed film.
Got it.
And then you send it off to the lab, or you develop it yourself.
And of course, the chemistry is the same, but all of the holders and the physical objects have to be adapted to a 5x4 negative. And then you have to have a 5x4 enlarger, right? You can't just, you have
to... Well, if you go that far, I'm still in the hybrid stage, so...
You don't do your own printing yet.
I throw those on a scanner.
You scan them?
You scan them. There are flatbed scanners that do that.
That's probably a good idea.
And you
What kind of resolution are you getting?
You end up with 200 to 300 megapixels.
200 to 300 megapixel images. Wow.
So it's really, there's a lot of information in here.
Sure.
And it is...
Now, this is a good example. This is a time exposure of somebody playing with fire. So that's a 1 second or 2 second shot probably.
That would be 4 to 5 seconds.
Four or five, okay.
Yeah. So someone juggling fire. We did this last year on a workshop here.
What fun. What fun.
So 300 megapixels out of one of those...
But
obviously you can enlarge them. There are 4x5 enlargers.
I think you really do want to get it into a computer at this point, because how else are you going to share
it? That's what I do. And I take my digital analog pictures, I scan them, and then I continue working on them in Lightroom. Very simple.
Wow. And Lightroom will handle it.
Lightroom will handle them.
They're going to be big files.
On my little MacBook Air, it takes a while for them to load. But
I think it's a great exercise, because it's kind of a more thoughtful and careful.
It is a thoughtful approach. And by the way, I see a lot of younger photographers on my analog workshops. They come because they want to find out what this is about. They want to. They grew up in a digital world.
Right.
They never shot a roll of film, and they want to know what the fuzz is about. And most of them get addicted very, very quickly.
Well, this isn't just film. This is film with a capital F. Even I, who shot, I'm old enough to have shot film for most of my life. I never have tried this.
What I really like about that approach, the analog approach, is that you have to make a decision and stick to it. And that is something that I believe a lot of people have forgotten how to do, because you have choice and choice and choice. You choose digital, you can have 50 different developments in Photoshop or Lightroom or Aperture, and you end up with
picture.
It's not that, but it's very hard to be happy with what you have,
right?
Because you always second guess. Oh, could I have done it better? Oh, the sky needs a bit more dark. Once you do this, yes, you will not get every shot you want, but you will be stuck with your decision, and that in the end
that's
will
what I'm afraid of. Is this one of yours? That's gorgeous.
That's one of the 4x5s that I shot.
That is gorgeous. So This is black and white, or did you turn it into black and white?
No, I shot this black and white. I actually shot this with a red filter in front of it.
Oh, yeah, so that's where the contrast is.
What the red filter does, it takes the... let me just bring one up here. I got everything with me. What that filter does, it on a black and white, it lets red light through, and it blocks out other colors. So if you look at that picture, a red filter like this, you would hold that in front of the lens. It's a very simple approach, but look at what it does to the sky.
Yeah, no, I love the effect.
The sky goes, the blue of the sky doesn't like go through painting. The filter, so it comes out much, much darker. Yeah. You end up with a very contrasty picture. You can have that in glasses. I have this pair of glasses, and it's a slightly rose-tinted thing.
Yeah. They're called blue blockers.
And all of a sudden, you look at the clouds.
Yeah.
When you drive on the highway, you see the clouds.
Wow.
They take the glasses off, and
it's
the effect
boring.
Is gone.
So, yeah.
That is definitely a good way to do this.
We're talking with photographer Chris Marquardt. He's our photo guy on the Tech Guy show, and a good friend of Twit. We just really love what he does, and every year or so he comes by and spends a day on photo day. We're going to do, is it daguerreotypes? We're going to do classic.
No, tintype.
Tintypes, even older.
Wet plate collodion photography.
In a little bit, we'll also talk about aerial photography using kites.
Yes.
This is a lot of fun. We are watching the chat room. What's the hashtag people should use on Twitter?
The hashtag on Twitter is PhotoDay2012. So if you are on Twitter, let me just refresh that. PhotoDay2012.
Yeah, because I wasn't paying attention.
New tweets.
See if there's any questions. PhotoDay.
Thanks, Paul, for the feedback on the group shots. That was
I love those pictures.
Yeah.
That was so nice.
Do you have any recommended methods? That's Zach. Do you have any recommended methods of cleaning camera lenses for a first-timer like me? I do. It's a very DIY approach. Use roll paper.
Toilet paper?
No, roll paper.
What's roll paper?
As in cigarette paper.
Oh, rolling paper.
Rolling
zigzags.
Paper. Zigzags. You can get those for almost no money at a cigarette store, if there are any of these around still. I don't know.
Sure. We have four head shops at Petaluma alone.
Awesome. So you'll have... Just make sure no one sees you going in there. But this is actually a very effective way to get grease off your lens, to get a lens clean.
Interesting.
And you're not going to cost anything. You scrunch them up. You pretty much hold them at the side that you would lick, at the sticky side. You hold them there. You scrunch them up. Wipe the lens. It feels weird, but it is softer than any coating on the lens can ever be.
Wow.
So it's a very safe way to do that. So
bring some zigzags with you next time.
Bring some zigzags, but make sure you...
If you think about it, the lens paper that I buy, which is very expensive
for
my
lens,
is the same exact...
It's pretty much the same stuff,
a soft fiber paper is basically what it is.
Right. And then the roll paper, you just scrunch it up and toss it.
And don't put the glue side on the lens.
No, don't
Good
use the glue
tip.
Side. They're actually glue-free rolling papers, too.
For the really...
You can get ones that don't have any glue attached
to
them. So, I think that that concludes our show and tell. And I'm actually going to take this camera to Colorado in a couple of weeks.
I'm so jealous.
And
I
will
think this
go
is
out
really cool.
to the remember the wildfires there around Fort Collins.
I'll hook you up with a woman whose home was burned down.
Oh, awesome.
She's a radio host, Tanya Hall, in Colorado, and lost everything. There was just ashes left.
So what we want to do is go out to the forest, to the burnt-up forest, and take some hopefully impressive wide-angle pictures.
Remind me, and I will I'm sure Tanya would love to show you around. Amazing story. She's fine, and everything's fine, but very tragic. She said she had 15 minutes. 15 minutes before it burned down, they said, you need to get out now.
Yeah.
Imagine having 15 minutes and getting everything that you want out of your house. She lost pretty much everything.
My friend John Miller, who lives in the area, the rest of Everest.
That's right. He's there. Huh?
He lives in Fort Collins, and he was evacuated. Luckily, nothing happened, but he was evacuated for, I think, a week.
Yeah. Really sad.
Question by Graham McPhee. Could you please talk about tips for beginners trying analog photography? Well, it's...
You don't want to start with a view camera.
Get an SLR.
The good news is you can go on eBay and get an OM-1 or a classic, an FM, a Nikon FM.
An Nikon, a Canon analog.
And get manual. SLR. Get a manual camera and you get great lenses and it's nothing.
You will get them for $20. $30, maybe 50.
It's cheap.
It's really cheap. It's actually cheaper than starting off with a digital SLR because the startup cost is so low. You can get any film developed at Costco's as long as it's a 35 millimeter roll. You will not have an issue. They still have labs that they send these things to, so you don't have to start with your own development. Just drop them off. Get the negatives back. Some of them even offer a scanning service, so you can have
get a CD back with your
pictures. So that's definitely a thing to try. And you, really, the startup cost is almost nothing. And you can see if it works for you. And if it doesn't, then just no big loss there. How I shot the solar eclipse. JH60 sent us a link about the solar eclipse.
You know, I'm curious. Now, we did a segment on shooting the solar eclipse on the radio show, and I was kind of thinking about it because I'm going to see a total eclipse in November on our Australia cruise.
Yeah.
And I'm just not ready for this at all because I forgot all your tips. So.
Well, you want a very, very strong solar filter.
That's right.
We call it an ND filter, neutral density.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sunglasses for the camera. And you will want one of those that is very, very strong so you can turn down. Or what some photographers do, they use a pinhole approach. Take a box, like a shoebox on one side open, put a pinhole in one side, and that will project onto a piece of paper. So you end up with the sun projected onto a piece of paper, and you can shoot that.
Look at this. I was just searching on eBay. Here's an Olympus OM-1. With all of this stuff, the current bid is $43.
Yeah, and that'll probably go. That's 1 day, 3 hours left. So that'll go up to maybe $60, $70.
Unbelievable. Yes. Now, one thing you should be kind of aware of is some of these older lenses can get kind of funguses in them, right? I mean, there's.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
Not worry about that?
No, not too much. Yes, you can have bad luck, but then a 51.8. An old used 51.8, you will find one for little money if you need to replace
these. I love my OM-1. These are nice compact SLR film cameras that were just really, really nice.
Louis Pipkin, how does the startup cost for black and white processing and a view camera compare to digital? Well, the view camera you can get a used Graflex camera for as little as a couple hundred bucks. Most of them have a lens with them. If not, you can get start up with like $300 on a view camera actually, and then again there are professional labs that will develop film for you. But if you want to do it yourself, if you ever developed film, it's the same thing.
Some films are easier to process than others. Ektachrome was very easy, simple process.
Yeah.
Some are a multi-step process. Black and white's pretty easy. I used to.
As long as you go color, negative, it's just one process.
That's not bad.
It's like three steps, but it's the same process, fixed time. So
here's for $279.
An enlarger.
An enlarger. Complete darkroom. Mm. The bath. Everything you need.
Yeah.
Look at that.
And you see a lot of these on
because there's
right
a lot of film photographers who are getting out of the business.
Now's
a good time.
And there is quite a resurgence of now. Now is the time when a lot of people who were looking at medium format, enviously looking at medium format, now they can all of a sudden afford this because all of the pros are not in that business anymore. So there's an entire wave of amateurs going into medium format and getting a Rolleiflex or a Mamiya camera or a Hasselblad.
Look at this. For $700, a
Hasselblad
500.
500cm. Is this a...
You know, I should just buy this right now. That is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have cost thousands in the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And this is one of the great cameras of all time.
And you see how modular it is, so you can take the back off and put something else on. Actually, on those, you can now put digital backs on.
That's
so
right.
They are still compatible most of the time.
Oh.
So you could even...
And these are the ones that you look at the top down and you advance the film with that really that dial there. This is great. Oh, this is so cool.
So this stuff is now all of a sudden accessible to amateur photographers who wouldn't have been able to do this 15 years ago.
There's no bids on this one.
Well.
That's maybe too much. Maybe we shouldn't pay so much for a Hasselblad.
Well, you want to look and see
Shop around.
What's there. Shop around a bit. And have
look
a
at this one. This is
It's a 6x9. A folding 6x9 plate camera. Which one is that?
I don't see the brand. This looks pretty old.
Something German.
Here's a 500 for $550 with the 80mm lens. You want a Lomo?
This is
Mamiya. Wow.
Amazing, yeah.
It's a good time to get into film photography.
It certainly is, and there is still a lot of film out there. And it'll slow you down, but it'll teach you a lot of lessons.
Wow.
You know the saying: if it was hard to learn, it'll be hard to forget. There's a bit of a learning curve there.
I know that I would take 10 pictures and they'd all be junky, and I go, oh, screw it, and I go home.
Well, if you have a good teacher,
I need a better teacher.
Anyway, so thank you, Leo.
Very nice. I thank you, Chris. Chris is going to continue on. Lots more to come.
Yes.
I'm going to get out of your hair. Should I leave this here? And,
no,
you got your
own
laptop?
I'll get my own laptop.
Do you have HDMI out of that laptop?
No, but I have a mini display port.
Mini display port will work as well.
Yeah.
All right.
So thank you. And next up is Chris Benton with Kite Aerial Photography.
How
so
fun.
We're going to look at some really awesome stuff in a few minutes. And
thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Leo. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. Photo Day continues with Chris Marquardt.
Yes.
I'm going to move out of here. Let you take over.
Have a good day, sir. All right. So, old technology. Lots of old technology. Can we gazelle it later? I'm not sure gazelle wants these old cameras. Not sure about that. Yep, 12 pictures on a roll of 120 film. That is about right. And actually, sometimes I end up shooting a roll of 120 film and not even being able to fully fill that in an afternoon because I take so much care. So let me put this together. Let me hook up the laptop because we'll have some show and tell there. I'm going to do this in a second. Yes. Oh, actually, let me put this to the side. I think we can leave it here as decoration. So hands up on Twitter. Who's here from Germany? It's past midnight now. Are you guys still up? All right, so can I see the wide shot, Tony?
Yeah. I actually have one that's facing the pike.
I just want to see. I want to, like, put a bit of decoration here.
Okay. Maybe we go wider if you like.
Well... Maybe, no, a bit closer in. There we go, leave it at that. Let's go. Again, just. All right, so I think we're all set here. So, Tony, you have the video ready for,
yes,
for Chris?
Yes.
So I'm probably not gonna show anything off the laptop for this segment. So you'll have to run the video. And Chris, did you give Tony pictures? Okay, so Tony should be all set. I'm still. Let me unplug this for a second. Stuff here. So it's Photo Day, photography outside the mainstream, and I'm pretty sure you guys, this is going to be exciting. Actually, why don't you bring in the kite and set it up in the background, I think. No, don't think it is heavy.
Yeah, it's light as a feather.
It should be. My laptop, what's wrong with you? Boot on me. Denmark. Odin from Denmark.
Danish. Okay,
we can turn this light underneath off.
Okay. There you go.
That is good. Looking good. Any thoughts on the newest Canon 7D, Kafka? On the new 7D update. Well, I think it's pretty cool that that Canon pretty much added a bunch of new features. They've done this on, I think they started doing that, adding features with updates with the 5D Mark II when they had the entire new video processing in there, and they were adding like manual audio control and manual exposure for the video. And I think it's actually a good tradition. I think it makes you, I think it's also good from a marketing point of view, because you can assume that some of those features will be updated in the future. So whatever you get is probably going to get better in the future. So I think, here we go. I think that's a good thing. So I like that. Geezer guy, hi Chris, have you used the bridge camera lately? If so, what would you say is the best? No, I have not. Bridge cameras are, well, in between the point and shoots and the DSLRs, they usually have fixed lenses. Some of them a bigger sensor. I'm pretty much a DSLR guy, so, and a large format guy. So bridge cameras, not really. My problem with bridge cameras is they are kind of not here, not there. They try to be everything. I think the Micro Four Thirds and the smaller system cameras, the mirrorless cameras that are coming out now, are really, really interesting. I think they do. They're starting to fill that gap, and you get the advantage of being able to change lenses. So you'll be able to get good quality lenses, different primes. Canon just announced the M class cameras, so they will actually have a new mount, the M mount, and that will. They designed all these nice pancake lenses, the 22 and the 40 millimeter pancake lens. So you have a relatively small camera with a decent sized APS-C sensor that will give you good control over depth of field and still be kind of pocketable, and with the added advantage of being able to use your old SLR lenses and put them on there. So I think that is probably the way to go if you want something more advanced. But again, if you don't want to change lenses, if you want to have this one camera that you take with you all the time, maybe a bridge camera is the right thing for you. I think there's always cameras always always depends on what you want to use them for. So how do you deal with hot pixels on a Canon 7D? You're getting into astrophotography. That's Tavio. Well, hot pixels can be an issue in astrophotography. I would, I think you can have Canon service map them out for you, and they're pretty much impossible to avoid because hot pixels are pixels that are stuck in the on state. So there will be like this one bright green or one bright blue or red pixel always looking at you, and especially in longer exposures, they will come out. You'll see them. Today's software is pretty good though. On my 5D Mark II, I have like several hundred hot pixels. This camera is 3 years old. It's been on airplanes a lot. I've traveled with it a lot. And every time you fly in an airplane, you have this cosmic radiation, the cosmic particles that hit the sensor, and they will sometimes kill a pixel or light it up and kind of fuse it in an on or off state. So the off ones are the dead pixels, the on ones are the hot pixels. But I wasn't aware that I had that many until I looked into them outside of Lightroom, because Lightroom and Aperture and all the other software has a very easy time of detecting them and taking care of them. So what you get is a picture with 300 hot pixels, and the software simply maps them out for you. So that, that was a bit of a surprise. But after talking to a particle physicist back in April, I learned that there's pretty much nothing you can do about that. It's just going to happen sooner or later. Actually, the bigger sensors are more prone to getting these kind of issues, because it's a simple game of statistics, you know? Bigger sensor means more surface to hit, right? The smaller sensor means it's harder to hit, it's easier to miss. So taking your camera up on a in an airplane will do that over time. So if you, maybe you should just not fly with a camera. Maybe you should be doing cruises on ocean liners from now on. All right, let's continue with Photo Day. Photo Day stage two. And I have a guest here who does some very interesting photography. His name is Chris Benton. And Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
To Photo Day. I'm really happy that you're here, that you could make this. Tell us a bit about what you do.
For about 20 years now, I've been taking photographs, low-level aerial photographs, in which I lift the camera with a kite. So the idea is you go out and fly a kite.
All right.
You rig up a camera so that it's stable enough to give you good images. And then you use that as a means of exploring the landscape.
I can see a whole lot of issues there.
Yeah, there are a few, right? Yeah.
So let's kick this off. So, and again, we'll go through in these individual questions about stability and field of view and how to aim and how to launch this thing.
Right.
Do you just go to like a kite store, buy any kite, and then hang the camera off of it?
You can. You know, with the internet now, there's some sort of specialty shops that deal with kites and sort of target them for kite aerial photographers.
Mm.
And so there are a couple of
really?
Those. Yeah. So we want a kite, a single line kite that goes and finds one place in the sky and just sort of stays there.
Oh, so the ones that you have two lines,
yeah,
they move too fast?
Right. In fact, when they're pulling the most, they're going the fastest.
Oh, okay. So you want a stable kite.
So we want a stable kite. So we audition kites for stability.
Okay.
And then in a way, it's not like golf clubs.
Do you do this just by looking at them? Or do you have like an accelerometer, like an iPhone hanging off of it?
I actually carry a fisherman scale, for instance, that I'll hook it up and see how much the
pull
is pulling.
Oh.
So I want 5 to 8 kilograms of pull, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess obviously depends on where you fly it and how much
wind
you have.
Yeah. So one of the difficulties is when you first start, you have maybe one kite, maybe two, and they fit certain wind ranges. It'd be like playing around a golf with one or two golf clubs.
Okay.
You know, so if you have to hit it really far, and you only have this short chipping wedge, that's a little tough to do.
So you have this selection of different kites with you, and
so you have a quiver of kites, and I put one back behind us.
Yes, we can see that.
Which is
huge.
Yeah, big. It's like 8 feet tall, and it's framed in these carbon fiber sticks that are very strong but light,
so they don't snap easily.
So that's good for light wind. So if the wind's blowing, you know, 7 or 8 miles an hour, you'd put out a big kite like this. But if the wind is blowing really fast, you pull out a kite that's small and tough.
Right.
All with the goal of having enough pull to lift the camera, but not so much pull that you have to fight it or it might break.
Okay, what kind of cameras are we looking at? Are we looking at something of this caliber, 5D Mark II, which is, I don't know how many pounds, but several pounds?
Yeah, there have been people that have flown 5Ds.
Okay.
But
they're very heavy.
All up, that would be 4.5 pounds maybe worth of stuff.
Okay.
Once you have the camera cradle and
stuff. So for that, you'd have to have a very good kite and very stable wind.
Bigger kites. It just sort of ups the ante in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And the stable wind has probably more to do with the amount of equipment, the investment of equipment you have.
But wouldn't a heavier camera be better because it adds more weight and this way more
so.
Stability?
I think so. It's a good observation in a way that a lot of people try to get very lightweight rigs, thinking, that'd be easy to lift. But with very low weights, it's subject to windage.
Uh-huh.
It moves around a little bit more. So having some mass is good.
So there's a sweet spot somewhere in there. Okay.
So I started with 35mm point and shoot. I went to 35mm single lens reflex, so I just enjoyed your trip down memory lane here. And then I went to digital point and shoot. And now for the last 5 or 6 years, it's almost all been digital single lens reflex, not the 5D, though that I'd love to do it, but more the Canon Rebel entry level DSLR.
Okay, because they are pretty lightweight. They're
tough
in plastic casing, so which is I think ABS plastic. So it's the same stuff that like motorbike helmets are made from. So they are pretty.
You know, 20 years ago, I would have picked one up. Oh, you know, plastic.
Now
I pick it up and go, ooh, yeah, this is the
nice
ticket.
And lightweight. Yeah. And the image quality, you must be excited about this trend of the mirrorless cameras that have big sensors, like APS-C sensors,
right.
with much less weight in the package.
Yeah, I brought a cradle that carries the Sony NEX 5.
Okay.
It's fine, but I haven't ultimately warmed up to it. to tell you the
truth. Really?
I still like my wider glass on my DSLR.
The wider shots get a bit more expensive on those smaller sensor cameras because you need even wider lenses.
Right. Yeah. I'm waiting for the EOS M thing to play out to see what we get.
I'm looking forward to trying one of these when they finally come in the store. So, so stability is a factor of the wind, the pull, the size of the kite.
And a suspension. I think one of the key factors is you fly the kite, you launch it, you get it up maybe 150 feet, and then you have a conversation with it. It pulls, you maybe fly it for 10 minutes, and it'll tell you is the wind consistent or whether there are gaps in the wind. It'll tell you whether it's pulling enough to lift
the camera. So you feel the pull pretty much. So it's an experience thing, right?
Right. So once you've had that conversation after about 10 minutes, then you attach the camera where you stand.
Oh, you don't attach the camera to the kite?
No, but so it's attached to the kite line.
Oh, the kite goes up first.
Yep.
And then, I see.
Because a kite on a short line, 20 feet, 30 feet, is unstable.
Right.
But once you get it on a longer line, it sort of smooths out.
So how does the kite make its way up there?
Once the camera's attached to the kite line, let's say the camera's flying at 200 feet, then you let out more line. The camera goes from 200 feet to 300. It pulls the camera up after it. It goes from ground level to, say, 100.
Okay, so what are the heights you get?
The FAA would like for us to...
Okay, what does the FAA allow? Let's ask this question first.
You know, the FAA would like for us to stay below 500 feet.
All right.
So there are restrictions about how close you can be to airports and so
yes,
forth.
Yes, absolutely.
In my observation is that almost all the fun stuff comes from just above head height to maybe 250 feet.
Mm-hmm.
If you take images from 500 feet, you might as well be in an airplane.
I get this feeling, too. There's this point when you fly into an airport, and you look out the window, and at one point, everything's just so far away that it's like this one plane, and then at one point, it turns into features, and it turns into stuff that is really interesting looking.
Right.
And so you want that sweet spot somewhere there.
Now, one of the things I can do that you can't do in an airplane is I can sort of loiter. I can go to 50 feet above the ground and hang out and sort of work that turf where an airplane's speeding by or else it falls out of the air. Or a helicopter, if you're at 50 feet, is sort of a pretty chaotic thing. There's a lot of rotor wash and it's difficult.
And a lot of vibration.
Right. And pilots don't like to hover at that low level and
yes.
so forth. And they're expensive.
I think that's another thing. Renting a helicopter for aerial photography is probably a lot more expensive than flying a kite.
Right. So you build up a little set of gear. I've got a backpack here.
Well,
which is what I go into the field with.
Let's have a look at a few things. Let's do some show and tell here.
It's about, you know, 20 pounds worth of stuff.
Oh, so you just take that one with you? Are the kites part of that too? Or
I would have six kites in here. Oh. I would have two camera rigs, a radio control. And then,
this pack's pretty small. I've seen you come in with that. So you have all these rods, these
there
carbon
actually
rods.
Three of those kites in here.
There's
a 6 foot, a 7 foot, and an 8 foot of these, which is called a Rokaku.
Okay.
Six-sided kite. So they're good for lower wind.
So you get a lot of kites in it. This packs very nicely.
Oh, yeah. The overhead bin.
Yes.
Which is the mantra. I'll pull out a couple of things here.
Okay, let's see what you have.
The first thing that would come out would be kite line.
Okay, let's put this here so we can actually see.
So this is a halo spool. With about 1,000 feet of 100-kilogram test line on it.
100 kilograms, so it can take a pull of 100 kilograms.
That's the theory. I've never put 100 kilograms on it.
So well,
I try to keep it below 20.
That's 100 is a lot.
We can hang
it
from the rafters and hang on it.
100 is a lot, wow.
And so that's all of my kite line. Every kite I fly on this
with this same line. And how long have you been using that?
That's about 2 years old. I renew it about every 3 years.
Have you ever had a line snap and lose it?
I have never. No,
lose a kite or a camera?
That's nightmarish. Let's don't even talk about it.
And you don't have a safe... Okay, let's touch wood here. Yeah. You don't have a safety line or anything. It's just this one line.
Just one line. And the line's tough. It's good stuff.
Right, so you have a
gloves.
Glove.
And so these are mandatory. If you're flying with large kites,
you
need... I've been through 30 gloves.
Oh, yeah, because...
They wear out.
If you don't if you don't use a glove, you'll burn your fingers, right?
So I had 30 worn-out right-handed gloves
and
30 pristine left-handed gloves.
Wow.
And my friend Simon Harbord in Scotland, who's a kite photographer, is left-handed, so I sent off my gloves to Simon.
Wow. So...
So, that's good. There's
what is that for?
Oh, this is a fuzzy tail.
This looks like a cheerleader kind of thing.
Yeah, or a fashion accessory. It's about 10 meters of just ripstop.
Is that just for the looks, or does it stabilize the kite?
No, for the higher wind kites, I'll pull one out of the bag here, if I can reach down and get it. Let's see. It always gets caught down in the bottom here. Here we are. This is one of the higher wind kites. It rolls up like a windbreaker.
Okay. Oh, you can just, you
roll it up. It's really easy to travel with. But once you unfold it, it has openings.
And you can wear it if it gets if it starts to rain.
It's a survival
suit. Oh, so this is one that blows up like
so
a balloon,
it blows up
kind of.
Like a balloon. And that tail.
It's like a hang, like a paraglider kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
only,
material.
Only
very
stable
thin.
Stable rooftop nylon like a spinnaker.
Yeah.
And so this uses that tail, which sort of keeps it calm and faces these cells into the wind. Make sure.
Oh, because the tail is always in the back with the direction in the direction of the wind blows. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so
good stuff.
Let us see. We have the kite. We have the line. How much do you see from up there? How big is the field of view?
Depends on the lens, right? And I'm a wide angle kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm
flying. Also kind of dictates to not go too high because then everything disappears. Wide angle stretches out that depth. So,
and if you think about most low-level aerial photographs, people shoot a short telephoto out of an aircraft trying to get close to the ground. So I stay close to the ground and shoot wide, and it's really a different look.
Uh-huh. It is, yeah. It gives you more of that immediate being there feeling.
Yeah.
Telephoto doesn't do that. It gives you more of a paparazzi watching the thing from the outside feeling.
And it's a lot easier to aim.
Oh, yes, because we have more
because
in the
I'm
shot.
Because I'm not
yeah.
with the camera.
Okay, so you have that camera up there.
Mm-hmm.
It is stable enough to take pictures. How do you know what you're seeing?
You know,
what the camera is seeing. Do you have a remote transmitter? Yeah, or
there are a couple of answers. I'm gadget prone.
Mm-hmm.
I've made maybe 12 of these cradles that hold a camera.
Okay.
You can send video down. So you could have a video monitor that has
should
a
real time. Right?
Yeah, I've built three that do that.
Uh-huh.
But I found I never used them.
Why not?
Well, in part because I have a radio control in one hand. I've got a kite flying from the other hand.
You're holding the kite. You have to trigger the camera in some way, trigger the shutter. So how do you do that?
We should look at a cradle.
Let's have a look at that.
Okay. So the kite's up at 150 feet.
Mm-hmm.
You put a suspension. There's a little string and pulley job.
Oh, wow.
Which is a suspension, and that's this.
Okay.
And this attaches
this
to the kite line.
Has a specific name. I don't remember
it's
it.
It's called a picovet.
A picovet.
Named after Pierre Picovet, an inventor in 1912.
All right. So this is like four little pulleys and strings.
Right.
And
beautiful little pulleys that are from the radio control sailboat racing world.
Oh, okay.
And these arms were harvested out of a hard drive from an IBM AT.
Is this the arm of a hard drive?
The arm of a full bay hard drive.
This is very geeky. I love that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, when you're making this stuff, you use a lot of bearings out of old floppy drives or pieces of old typewriters or gears from a...
I'll never look at a hard drive the same way now. Okay, so the camera hangs on that.
On this.
What does that do? Why are we using one of these?
What happens with those
pulleys? Can I
have
a quick look? So
yep.
Is it this way? So the string is on top?
Yeah, what happens? You have to undo the string.
Yeah.
So we'll unzip this.
Oh, okay. It's like
knitting. And once that's unzipped, this has attachments at two points on the kite line.
Uh-huh.
And I'll foreshorten that a little bit.
Yeah, let's keep it in the view. Actually, we're seeing video right now.
Yeah. And so when the camera hangs below that cross,
yes,
the weight of the camera and the pulleys sort of work together.
Oh, look at that. You can move it.
It levels itself relative to the ground.
This is amazing. So I can just move that around, and it'll pretty much stay parallel. It'll not tilt.
Yeah, the wind will knock it around a little bit.
Yeah,
but it's a nice solid state, old school self
wow.
thing.
Wow. Like this feels very stable.
It's good.
Cool.
Yeah.
I like that. So you have the camera hanging off of that. No, you have the cradle hanging off of that.
The cradle, right.
So we're not. This is not directly attached to the camera. This
right.
is.
Mm-hmm. So we'll deal with that later.
Let's leave it here. That's okay.
And then the cradle is something you build from the camera outward. And it's...
Oh, now this is electrical. This is mechanical.
Well,
this is
sort of part Victorian engineering, part modern-day radio
control
stuff.
Okay, so this here is the little platform you put the camera on?
Yes. So I'm going to just... The way I would set up on the field is I would slap this guy on the side.
And that is a...
That's a GPS recorder.
Okay.
So I can geotag images later.
Oh, I see.
And then I screw on four little legs, and those legs are basically sort of allow it to sit on something other than the camera when it's near the ground.
Oh, so it keeps it off the ground.
Or if it falls, these legs are sacrificial.
Right.
And they have really helped a lot. They sort of bend out of the way and absorb some of the shock.
So I assume that it happens that the cameras fall
every now and then. Recently, had a nice whack out in the Marin Headlands. I was photographing coastal defense works in turbulent winds and had a camera come down maybe, I don't know, 15 feet, hit this rocky
Ouch.
Embankment.
Well,
but
then,
it tore up the legs, but the camera did fine.
But then today's cameras are really, really sturdy. So let's take this out of the way. So here we have the little cradle standing on its four legs.
We'll slap a little battery on here. That's just a four AAA.
So it's just Velcro. You put this on using Velcro.
Yeah. Normally I would thread one of these legs through there, so it's
okay. So it's a bit
attached.
Safer and won't fall. So we have this thing. We have a little platform that actually let's take it this way around, facing the camera.
Okay.
So we have this little platform here, and it's got all these gears here and a little chain here. So it will allow you to remote control the...
With the radio, I'll be able to turn through the compass, tilt from straight down to the horizon.
Can you show that?
Yep. Flip from...
Okay, let's do it. Okay. Let's do it.
Let's get a camera on there. I'll be able to flip from portrait to landscape.
Help you to hold it.
No, it's okay.
So you must have like a workshop that you machine all these things in.
It's mostly hand tools. They're like little sketches in the workshop. So I've got a little benchtop drill press.
Uh-huh.
And recently got a milling machine.
Oh, wow. So
that was before the day of this. Right, so we're going
to... So if anyone wants to get into this, you can actually get this done with pretty standard tools.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Most of this. Okay, so you have the shutter.
Yeah, I just plugged a remote cable into the electronic remote for the Canon, which goes back to a radio-controlled relay. So I can do a shutter half-press or a shutter full-press.
Oh, you get both states there?
Mm-hmm. And let's see if I crank that up.
Now you need a transmitter.
Yep. So here's the transmitter, which also comes out.
This does not look like you buy it in a store like this.
Well, you sort of do. I mean, it's close. The transmitter was a typical radio-control airplane transmitter.
Uh-huh.
2.4 gigahertz.
Yeah, but these are wider.
Right, so. And then they have two thumbsticks.
Yes.
And so I opened it up to look to see what circuit boards were in it and realized that the circuit boards had gotten really quite small.
Oh, so it's mostly air in there.
Yeah. So I...
Oh, you just
this is bits
this
and pieces of the original thing. I just ran it through the bandsaw and made new finishing pieces. And then I made the potentiometers instead of being the thumbsticks.
Okay.
Good for airplanes. I made something that sort of made more sense for my camera. So this wheel rotates through the compass. This sliding potentiometer.
Can we show this in
tilts?
Action?
Yeah.
So let's set this somewhere on the table here so we can see it in the camera.
Yeah.
Actually, let me hold it. I'm going to pretend.
It has to hold from here.
Yeah. I'm doing this now, and I'll be very good about this. So I'm holding
so now
this.
I'm
going
to tilt up.
Oh, look at that!
I'm going to turn around.
Turn it around.
I can hit a switch and go landscape to portrait.
Wow! Look at that.
And so you basically put this thing in the sky where you want it.
And it's one-handed operation.
Yeah, I strap it to the back of my hand, so I'm flying the reel of here. I'll grab it.
This is
the
so
reel of kite
cool.
line here.
Okay, so you have these two things.
And I have this strapped to the hand.
Right. So you get to do all the settings.
If I had turned the camera
on. You turn the camera on, that helps.
You always check
hold
that
on,
before
let me
you
put
send
this
it
down.
Up.
I have to change my finger. Cause
right, it is
here we
difficult
go.
To hold.
Here we go. Okay, and then... Okay. What you would do is aim the camera. There's a focus here, so we got a half press.
Well, and for we're some
getting
reason,
a half press. It's not getting focused because there's a lens cap.
Oh,
on
lens
there.
Cap. Yeah.
Put the lens. Take the lens cap off.
There we go.
I want to hear this. Yeah. Okay. Here's the exposure. So there we go.
Yep. And so I've now done about 300 and something flights with this cradle. I started flying with it in 2007. And I do a lot of my work out over the South Bay salt ponds. And so it's one of these situations where you cannot afford to have it.
Actually,
come
we've
down.
I think we have some video of the South Bay.
Yeah, this
salt
is actually
ponds.
On San Francisco Bay at Fort Mason.
That's down by Point Fort. What's the name of that?
It's by the Presidio.
Yes, down there.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is the South Bay. Here we are.
This is the South
and
Bay.
So this is a long-term project for me. I've been photographing this landscape, which is a landscape in transition. It was taken over for 100 years to produce salt, evaporating water for salt. And now they're returning a lot of this acreage back to a natural landscape. And when you're down there, it's really flat. You can sort of you see a lot of sky reflected in the water. You don't really see the features that one might be interested in the landscape. But by getting my camera up in the air and looking down, all of a sudden I can see the color of these salt ponds. I can see details down in the bottom. It really opens up a world.
And the geometry, the structure of everything.
It's for me, a sustained fascination.
Look at these pictures.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the different colors come from microorganisms that live at different salinities.
Wow.
And it's a startlingly visual landscape.
This is amazing.
Yep. So there's one of those soft kites flying, the Sutton Flow Form.
Is there any competition out there? Do you fight for the good spaces with other kite aerial photographers?
And not down there. You have to actually get a fair number of permits to do that.
Right.
And because to be in the wildlife refuge. But there is a large and a very pleasant community of kite aerial photographers. There are probably, 20 in the Bay Area.
Oh.
And there's some really good
more than
ones,
I thought there
yeah.
would be.
Yeah.
So you, wow, look at these pictures. Oh, this is amazing stuff.
It, you know, there's one thing, photography to me has a capacity to reveal things to us that we don't acquire through our native senses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can think about a whole thing, strobes freezing time or a long lens giving us hawk-like vision.
Right.
And this, in a way, by displacing our point of view from the ground to a little bit above, all of a sudden we see things that we wouldn't see otherwise.
Exactly.
Yep.
So how do you scope out locations? Do you go like on Google Earth
or something?
And that must be a godsend.
I've been using it ever since it used to be Keyhole.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Back before Google bought it. And
yes.
It is. You're able to sit in your armchair and browse these places. I also look at old maps a lot, a series of maps.
Right.
And old aerial survey photographs.
And so is this how you found this location, those salt ponds?
Or
were they just around?
One of my sons wrote a term paper about that project in high school. And I was driving by and thinking, wow, I ought to go take a look at it.
Are these colors as apparent from the road as they are from up there?
When you're standing there and you look across the pond,
you see mostly the sky reflection.
The sky reflection, yes. Yeah. And if you stand right at the edge of the pond and look down, you can see these vivid colors.
Wow.
But only at your feet. They disappear pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started, I sort of went through three phases in all of this. I looked, here are a series of photographs from down in the South Bay. That's the salt production plant. But I spent, 6 or 7 years just working on technique. And then I spent another 6 or 7 years just being sort of giddy about textures and color. And now I've gotten a sense that it's revealing things about this transitional landscape that go beyond the sort of compositional play of the images, but really like this old boat landing.
Oh, with the shadows and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that...
Reveal a past that is sort of disappearing before us.
And,
I like that shot.
This is beautiful.
Those are old
stuff.
Piles from a landing. It used to be the boat landings in the San Francisco Bay were a sort of a major geographic feature because that's how we move stuff around.
Right. So what's your keeper ratio? How many pictures do you take in an hour, and how many of them are then actually?
It was funny listening to your earlier conversation about analog film versus digital. It used to be I'd have to pull down and reload every 24, every 36, and you would think a bit more. Maybe when you had a limited number of shots.
The digital leads you to more of a spray and pray thing, but I think with this type of a photography, that's necessary, right?
Yes and no. I think you can avoid the spray and pray, or I try to do it, by thinking through a list of shots I would like to have before I ever send the camera up, by having a sort of punch list of
here's what I want. You start with the vision.
And then you compose by watching this thing floating through the air, aiming it, saying, I want that oblique, just clipping the horizon, looking toward the Coyote Hills, or I want to look down at the salt pond that's being drained.
Oh, look at this.
So if you have intentions before you start, that helps. And then the one thing that's wonderful about digital is it allows me to compositionally bracket. So I'm lining the shot up as best I can, mm-hmm. but I will sort of hedge my bet by shooting a little higher and shooting a little lower, shooting a little bit to the left, shooting a little bit to the right.
Yeah, I do this with when I do street photography. I shoot from the hip.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes you learn to aim without looking through the viewfinder, but then it's still gonna be only 90%. So,
but the more you do it, the better you get.
Oh, sure.
You know, there are a lot of things like that. So, sure. So I've now gone out.
Is there a good way to practice that aiming, or is it just experience?
It goes back to having that real-time viewfinder. So I've got this theory. I'm calling what I do a bit interrogating the landscape.
Right.
But it has to do with having a visual hypothesis, trying to have a mind's eye image of the image,
right,
of a photograph that you'll get, and then comparing that to what comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a good sort of visual hypothesis,
yes,
you really don't know how to evaluate what came back. But if you do have a good visual hypothesis,
you'll look at it and see, does it
match? You look
at
it and say, wow, how did I get that? That much off, or why didn't I notice that green texture here along the marsh channels and the salt?
You would probably not notice from being down there.
I had not. I can remember that. Yeah.
So sometimes you get nice surprises.
Yeah.
Wow! Look at these pictures. Yeah, this is just
dredge marks.
Absolutely brilliant.
I enjoy it enormously. it is time well spent.
So how much time do you spend doing that?
I've been doing. I mentioned that I go back. I started in 95, early 95, and it's been a Sunday afternoon mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so I get out maybe 40 or 50 times a year. I'm recently retired,
mm-hmm.
And so now I'm amping it up. I'm getting more field work, and I'm really looking forward to taking more images. So I've been out, I don't know, about 15 times in the last 2 months.
Have you ever thought of making these into a book?
Yeah, working on it.
Working on it. Yeah. Good, yeah. Very good.
Right.
When is it going to be out?
2013, if I'm lucky, and it's about the South Bay work. These are
really amazing pictures.
Yeah, but there'll be a technical appendix about the how to do it.
I think, and this speaks very much to the audience of this channel of the Twit Network,
right?
This is, I think, a very very good mixture of a geeky technical approach, and a creative side to create. Things that are really stunning and using the technology in a good way, as opposed to going, I need to spend more money to get a better lens and then I'll be a better photographer.
Yeah. I worry about spending more money because it means I have more stuff flying around up there in harm's way.
So you haven't lost a camera yet?
I have lost two.
Two?
Yep. They were both during my digital point-and-shoot phase. They were Canon digital Elves.
Mm-hmm.
Dropped one in San Francisco Bay.
Oh, did it just fall off the cradle?
No, I was at China camp. It was one of those days when there wasn't enough wind. I really wanted to get the shot.
Uh-huh.
And I fly out on one of these kites that has a frame. And the really nice thing about the framed kites is if the wind goes away, you can pull the line and sort of make wind by retrieving the line.
As kids, we used to run.
Yeah, yeah. So it's equivalent to that, but staying in place, just pulling the line.
Yes.
I have practiced pulling the line.
One-handed.
Yeah. So I was concerned about the wind going away. Indeed, it did go away when I had about 400 feet of line out.
Uh-huh.
I'm pulling the camera back in. I'm keeping it out of the water, though, with my practiced long strokes of in-haul. But a whole family, a whole group came and stood underneath the line, looking out at the water at this thing coming across the water surface.
Oh, so you were about to hit them.
Yeah, and they had little kids on the shoulders and so forth. And so I thought, I can't pull the camera through.
So you sacrificed your camera for kids.
Yep. That's so it went in the bay.
That's
yeah, it had, I'd gotten 20-something images on it. I threw it in fresh water, took the battery memory card out, took it home, rinsed it, baked it overnight at 150, and it by and large came back.
Okay.
But it was a little soft.
Oh, so there must have been some humidity in there.
Yeah. And so I thought about selling it as a senior portrait elf on eBay, special edition.
Very, very soft focus kind of thing all of a sudden. Oh, wow. So if people want to know more about this or find out more about this, do you have an official website or something?
I've got one that's embarrassingly old. I've got one that's like 2003 and I haven't touched, so I hate to point people to it. But there are resources on the web that are really great. There's a Kite Aerial Photography discussion group out of Berkeley. So if you search for Kite Aerial Photography discussion, you'll get that.
Uh-huh.
There is a Kite Aerial Photography group on Google,
uh-huh.
and lots of stuff there. And it's a really a friendly community. People
all right,
are
very supportive. Just use your favorite search engine and search for kite error photography, and you should probably get quite a bit of good
there
stuff.
Is a lot, yeah.
All right. And there's this video of you that we've seen portions of here. Which
that's
is,
on YouTube or Vimeo.
Which has been done by Make Television.
Right. Make, bless their souls, I was in the first issue of Make.
Oh,
so that cemented my geekdom for my sons.
Very, very cool. So, Chris, thank you so much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
And I'll be looking more into this. This is
good.
This
looks fun.
I've been looking into helicopters and stuff lately. But I haven't really gotten around to learning it properly.
The quadcopters are really interesting.
The quad and octocopters hexacopters are looking very promising, and they should be a bit easier to fly than real helicopters. So, anyway, aerial photography is cool. So, thank you so much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
All right. This was good. This is very good. Now, watch the line down here.
I have to... when I had it all...
You're on it with your chair.
Yeah. When there I had it all knitted together, it's because most of making
this is going to be a big mess.
Knots,
this is going to be... Oh, no, actually, it's not too bad.
Yeah. And so I made this length equal my length.
Oh, so it's easier to fold. Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. So this was cool. Getting some good feedback on the chat.
Good.
Very, very cool.
Chris's,
Will video be downloadable later of this? Yes, I'm sure, and Tony, you will correct me if I'm wrong, but this is going to end up as a Twit special. So it'll be on YouTube. All the 4 hours of it, probably not. Or maybe. Well, what I'm going to do is I will try to get a copy of the video. I'm not sure how many gigabytes is going to be in the end, but I've brought a big hard drive. I'm trying to sneak a copy of the entire video out of here, and I will release that in pieces over on my podcast on Tips from the Top Floor. So if you watch that, there will be reruns of this on my show, which is the longest running photo podcast in the world. So, as I said, we lost a guest. Help. So, I'm sorry, no tintype photography, because we, had a time zone thing. This is a strange country, these United States of America, with four time zones. Or are it even more? No, wait, we're talking four, right? Four, yeah. Well, Germany has one, and that's a good thing. So anyway, so we got a bit of an issue here, and I apologize for that. But then that's probably something we'll have to put into the next photo day. So I've opened the floor for questions, and I'd be happy to answer them. So let's see. Let me open my little form, because there is a form out there. If you go to tftf.com/photo day question. I've put up a little form that you can actually submit a question to. And then I have them here. Or you can just use the hashtag photoday2012. And a few ones already coming in. That is good. So let's look at a few of those. By Jeff Coe. Tracking buddy Jeff Coe. Chris, we've not heard from you recently about your saga with Lightroom 3 to Lightroom 4 conversion regarding issue with lost curves. Did this get resolved with the Lightroom 4.1 upgrade? Yes, it did. There was an issue with Lightroom 4 when it initially came out, and I was actually quite vocal about that. The migration to different... The migration of tone curves, which... not a lot of people use, but if you come from the Photoshop world and you're using the Curves tool, that is that's just a very convenient way, if you know how to use it, to work on the contrast in a picture. And the Lightroom 3.6 to 4 migration kind of lost all the tone curves. So I've had thousands of pictures with tone curves, and they were all gone after that. And it was an issue, because I wanted to use Lightroom 4 and it didn't work this way. So it took them a while to finally fix it, but Lightroom 4.1 fixed that issue. So that is resolved, and I can fully recommend Lightroom 4 now. It has those issues fixed. So it's all good again. Zach L. Zealand from the chat. Hey, Chris, I had a question regarding point-and-shoots. Do you know of any point-and-shoots that can handle HDR without usage of Photoshop? So you want a point-and-shoot that shoots multiple shots at different exposures and then kind of merges them into an HDR? I'm sure there is something like that out there, but I don't really know which one. So maybe someone in the chat can help you. John Farah, what's better, analog or digital? I'm not going to go there. Both have, well, actually, I will. Both have their advantages and disadvantages. Analog, as I said earlier, slows me down, makes me think more about the individual picture, and it kind of makes me decide for something. So I have to stick with a decision of if I'm shooting black and white or not. But digital will allow you to learn fast, to quickly see results. Usually when I do a commercial assignment, I shoot digital because I need all the choice later to fix pictures. If I have to, save an overexposed sky, for example. So in many ways, digital is more convenient, but I wouldn't want to miss analog. I've had a phase. I started off analog. I did 10 years of digital photography only, and then I was happy. I thought I'd never have to go back to analog because it takes so much time until things are developed. And I just rediscovered it like 3 years ago, and I don't want to miss it anymore. It's really changed my way of shooting digital too. So if you have a chance to, maybe someone at home, maybe your grandpa still has a analog camera somewhere in a cupboard somewhere, give it a shot. You can just take the film, drop it off at a drugstore, have it developed, and it's not really expensive. So, Chris, Carolyn Haynes asks, Chris, can you talk about infrared photography a little? Interesting in both film and digital. Mm-hmm. Infrared photography will... let's look at the spectrum of light. So we have a spectrum from that goes from all the way from infrared through red to blue and ultraviolet. So that's kind of the range. Infrared, we can't really see with our eyes, but the red spectrum is what we can see, and then all the way to the blue. And then when it goes ultraviolet, we can't see that anymore. So it pretty much comes in from black over red over all the orange, yellow, Roy G. Biv, right, over to blue and violet, and then it dips into the black again. Right, here's a picture of the spectrum. Thanks for pulling that up, Tony. And by the way, Tony running the board. Good man, thank you. So this spectrum is what we can see, but then there is more, and our eyes are tuned to that visible spectrum, but there are other animals and insects and other living beings that have a different spectrum, that see a different spectrum. So the infrared spectrum, a lot of these animals see that. We don't, but we can make it visible. And the way we do it is we use film, and it's typically black and white film, that is sensitive in that spectrum. So pretty much infrared film will see red and then beyond. And what typically happens in infrared photography is that you use a filter that filters out the visible light. You use an infrared sensitive film or an infrared sensitive camera. And that filter, as it blocks the visible light, is pretty much black to us. So you look through that filter into the light and you don't see anything because it looks black. But it lets through infrared light. And then you shoot pictures and you have a very interesting effect. Infrared pictures have almost a ghostly kind of appearance. The greens in the trees, for example, are pretty much white. So the landscapes in infrared look like they are in snow. This is a very good example. So, but this is not in winter. This is during the day. So you will see that the green leaves emit a lot of infrared, so they turn out white in here. The sky behind that tree doesn't emit a lot of infrared, so that pretty much goes very dark. And You can do this with film. You can do this very easily as long as you have an infrared sensitive film. If you have a film, if you have a digital camera, it's a bit more difficult because digital cameras have infrared filters in front of the sensor. If you open up a digital camera, you look at the sensor is actually not the sensor itself. There's like an entire package of 3, 4, 5 different filters in front of the sensor. And one of them is an infrared filter. It cuts out the infrared. It pretty much, makes it hard to take good infrared filters, the pictures. But there are cameras out there. I think Canon made a few that, I'm not sure, the 60D, the 60DA or something, that come without an infrared filter and that will allow you to take these kind of pictures. Angbor asks, how do you deal with questions of customers like, I want this or that, you know how to handle all that in one photo. Okay, so you're probably talking about demanding clients. Well, what I usually do is I try to have a whole bunch of pictures with me that I can show to a client and pretty much give them an idea what to expect and give them something to choose from, give them something to pre-visualize what you can deliver or what you're capable of delivering. And I try to build a good relationship with the client so that I try to build some trust, and that then helps in sometimes in convincing them that this might be a better idea than that. So I try to come from a visual approach because it's really difficult for most people who are not dealing with photography every day. It's very hard for them to explain things in plain language, or sometimes they might have a different picture in their mind, and what they explain might trigger a different picture in your mind than in their mind. So I think, the visual approach is probably the best one here. Dan from Colombia, I heard you mention using a shift tilt lens on one of your podcasts. What is the shift tilt lens and why would I want one? Well, we talked about this with Leo just a short while ago. The short of it is a shift lens will help you get shots of architecture with lines very straight, so you can keep perspective the way it is. If you tilt a camera, normally you tilt it back to get a higher building, you get falling lines, you get converging lines, and with a shift lens you can keep those parallel. And then the tilt will help you change the focal plane. It's very good in landscape photography, for example, or architectural photographers like those too. James has an input, not a question. Kite photos are more sophisticated than I thought. Not to change the subject, but I'm glad to hear you know about Octocopter, German engineered. Thanks again, thoroughly enjoy your perspective and knowledge. Thank you so much for that feedback. Let's see. Do we have anything on the chat? And let me... And actually, I see my next guest already in studio, the Silvermans. Good to see you. So, I don't know if Tony told you, but we've just lost one of our guests because he assumed the wrong time zone. So, we can probably do this a bit earlier so you will be able to get back to whatever you have to do after that. So I'm just answering some more listener questions here. Did you try a multicopter? Nice pics for you on Twitter. No, I didn't, but I've seen great stuff. I think they give you a lot of good opportunities. I've actually seen even though I'm not sure how nice this is, but I've seen a wildlife photographer use like a quadrocopter to shoot close-ups of lions. So he hovers over the lions, and I don't think you should do this, but it's definitely a good way to get your camera to places that you usually don't get it to. ShadowDog3 asks on Twitter, I'm a beginner and have Photoshop Elements. Are there good tutorials on the net? There are lots of tutorials. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure there are good ones. I'm not sure. I don't use Photoshop Elements. And I have my Photoshop knowledge from just using it years and years and years and trying different tutorials. So I wouldn't even be able to point you in one specific direction, but I think you'll have to do a bit of searching. There are a lot of good things on YouTube, so I would probably watch some videos. And then some of the regular Photoshop tutorials will probably also apply to Photoshop Elements because they are very similar in many ways. William Fowler, do they need to modify the cameras for a different atmosphere on Mars? That's a very good question. So Curiosity is up on Mars, and there was just an article on DP Review about the cameras on Curiosity. There are a bunch of different cameras there, and it's very interesting. They have 2-megapixel cameras up there, which if you look at the camera in any mobile phone, in any current mobile phone, 2 megapixels is nothing. But you have to keep a few things in mind, why this actually kind of makes sense now. When they plan a mission like Curiosity, they plan that years in advance. And this mission has been planned back in 2004. So in 2004, a 2-megapixel camera with, I think, 8 gigabytes of storage, that was pretty much a very good camera. And also one thing that's really important goes back to that hot pixel question earlier. You have a hot pixel on your sensor, and those hot pixels happen when you fly, when you partially leave the atmosphere, and you will end up there will be this cosmic radiation pretty much bombarding you and the sensor and your camera, so that can actually kill some of those pixels or switch them on. So just imagine the trip to Mars is so long, and there's no atmosphere that's shielding the camera or the sensors from that cosmic radiation. So you end up with probably a lot of radiation-related issues just from the trip there. So what they had to also do is they had to use a sensor that is kind of proven when it comes to radiation. So they couldn't just take the latest sensor because, You never know how good they are when it comes to coping with radiation. So they use a sensor design. It's actually a sensor made by Kodak that has all the tests and that where they pretty much know how good it copes with radiation. And then they have multiple cameras on board, and they, as far as I know, share the same sensor. So there are multiple cameras for close-ups, and there are 2 on the mast, one with a longer focal length, one with a shorter focal length, and they pretty much all have this same 2-megapixel sensor. And then what they can do is they can take multiple pictures and stitch them and make a panorama out of them, so they can actually artificially increase the amount of resolution by just taking multiple pictures. And the other thing that I find interesting is the amount of data they can transfer from Mars in a day is about 31 megabytes. So it's not a big DSL line up there. And the fact that it's 15 minutes of transfer time doesn't make it easier. So you have 30 megabytes, and that's not just pictures. That is the entire scientific data they capture up there. So it's really not a lot of data. So what they do is they send down very small thumbnails, and then they make a selection, and then they tell the rover, okay, send me the full resolution of this, send me the full resolution of that, and this way they pretty much optimize that bandwidth that they have. The colors is another thing about down here on Earth, you would have a gray card or something to do white balance. You can't. Well, can you do this on Mars? I mean, a gray card, why not? So you need to balance. You need to get a good white balance to make sure that Mars is not green, that it's actually the color it is. So they have different color swatches. Actually, that's in the DP Review article. They have these little sets of different colors, and a Lincoln silver penny from 1909 or something, and some resolution charts. And they have multiple of those up there, so they can point the cameras at them and get and use that to calibrate the cameras to get kind of a neutral color rendition of things. And one thing I learned the other day is that that was one of my questions. What happens if red Martian dust gets on these things? Now, you will have a wrong color balance. No, this arm has like different tools it can use, and one of these tools is a brush. So they pretty much can use a brush and brush off the dust off things, off lenses, and off these color swatches to make sure they get it right. So this is there's a lot of stuff going on. The atmosphere up there, and that goes back to William Follett's question. I'm not aware of any modifications you have to do for a different atmosphere. I think it's pretty much clear sight, same as here. So the atmosphere is thinner up there, so there won't be as much scattered light. Here on Earth, the reason why the sky is blue is because there's lots of stuff in the atmosphere that scatters the light, that takes that acts pretty much like a filter, and that makes the sky blue. If the higher you go in the atmosphere, the blacker it gets, and all of a sudden it's just a black space. And with less atmosphere, the only thing I think you might have to worry about is, at least here on Earth, the higher you go, the more infrared radiation you have. Now, what they have on Curiosity, on one of those cameras up on the mast, is a filter wheel. So they have in between the lens and the camera, they have this round thing with a motor, and in it is a filter wheel with different kinds of filters. So they have an infrared filter, and they have different kinds of filters to cut out different parts of that visual spectrum to be able to do their scientific stuff. And also with a regular infrared filter, kind of get nice color images and nice color rendition to have something to show down here. So Curiosity, from a photo point of view, I think it's very, very interesting. I like how they put this together. And you will see some really good pictures. I mean, they're already starting to come up with panoramas and stuff. But again, they have to sometimes take pictures. And those 15 minutes of delay, you send a command up there, and then it takes 15 minutes to get there and another 15 minutes to get something back. And so they pretty much set up this camera and say, okay, take this shot, then take this, then take this. And then it takes a long time to download those pictures. And then they will process them. And you will see some pretty stunning artwork and some pretty stunning photos coming out of that very soon. Serena Surfer. Chris, I use a D90 crop sensor. If I want to get more serious about photography, should I go full-frame sensor? That depends. I mean, I originally come from an SLR world, from a film SLR. That is the full-frame format that today's digital full-frame is based on. They both have their advantages and disadvantages. Crop sensors, I guess, are more useful if you want to shoot things where you have to zoom in a lot, lots of telephoto work. You can work with lenses and pretty much get just like the sweet spot in the middle, get good image quality from full-frame lenses and have a longer equivalent focal length. If you want to shoot lots of very wide angle, a full-frame is probably a good idea, because if you want to shoot super wide angle with a crop sensor, you'd have a super, super wide angle lens to do that, and those increase the price quite a bit. So just as a general rule of thumb. Also, bigger sensors obviously have bigger pixels, bigger individual pixels. So that will, even though the difference is not that big, but that will give you a bit of an advantage when it comes to low-light photography and less noise in your pictures. But having that said, I mean, I'm still shooting with a 5D Mark II, a three-year-old 5D Mark II, and that is still doing really, really well. Even though nowadays cameras, the current ones, they get a bit of a boost when it comes to low light things. Stay Jep, upgraded from the 5D Mark I to Mark III, and there are lots of options for autofocus. I be at MotoGP in October. Need to know my options. yes, the 5D Mark III has a lot of autofocus options. Most of the time, and I've tried the 5D Mark III. I haven't really spent a lot of time with it. The autofocus in the 5D Mark III is very good. But what I would typically do, and I think I would probably work the same way on the Mark III, is I would probably enable just the middle focus point. That's the most sensitive one, the most precise one. And then what photographers will often do is they will point it at something with a middle focus point. Again, the only active one, half press the shutter so it locks the focus and then recompose. And this way get the focus where you want it and get the composition the way you want it. You can even go further and put the focus just on this back button here. It's typically called back button focus. So you now independently have exposure and focus. I would assume that I would work pretty much the same way with a 5D Mark III. Just haven't really played too much with it yet. All right. Shaquille asks, what's your favorite city to photograph? Obviously, Shaquille helped me with a workshop back in Washington, D.C. last week. So it's got to be Washington right now. Even though we're here north of San Francisco, Petaluma is beautiful. Going to go up to Toronto next week to hold a large format 4x5 film workshop. So that is, that's then probably going to be my favorite city. And then after that, I'll be in Canyonlands National Park for a three-day photo. Well, we'll camp out there, landscape photography, adventure kind of thing. So then it's probably going to be Canyonlands National Park. So I'm always really in love with what I'm shooting at that moment. But Washington was awesome. All right. I guess we get our next guests on board. Here we go with part two. We just missed a guest, or a guest missed us because we had a time zone mismatch. So I'm really happy that you guys came a bit early.
We're early. Good. That's great.
It's very good. So Susan Neal Silverman, travel photographers extraordinaire. That's what I wrote down in the brief.
I saw that. I loved it.
And we have a common friend, Shaquille, who brought us together. And the stories that I've heard you tell and that he relayed are just. I'd have to have you here and tell us a bit about what you do. As far as I know, you've been to every single U.S. national park.
Well,
huh? No, but
not
many.
Many. A lot of them.
Okay, you teach photography, you travel, you teach photography, right. You shoot
stock photography.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a bit about your travels. What's the latest location you've been to?
Well, the latest greatest is right here because this is the time of year for all the wine to start getting harvested. And so, I mean, this is a major destination for people from all over the world to see the wine country.
So Sonoma, Napa as well?
Yeah. Sonoma, Napa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. It's a good year. Everything's really pretty now. Everything's good. You know, they have some years where they have trouble with the weather, but this year they've got a good harvest. And
so what are the things you can photograph in a wine location at this time of year?
Oh, my God. Well, first of all,
and this is August, just because this will probably be watched by people at different dates. But
right.
Yeah, well, we're doing a wine country workshop, but it's in middle, end of September. Mm-hmm. But the harvest goes all the way into October. And sometimes a little later, this year probably mid-October, I would think, would be coming toward an end. But then the colors come out. So as you get toward the end of October, beginning of November, you get into all the great colors.
So all of a sudden fall colors, yeah. Brown, green, yellow.
And then
gray.
Toward end of September, sometimes we can get colors and we can get the grapes on the vine.
The grapes are
and great. The grape workers and the harvest and the crushing.
And at the end of the day, a good glass of wine.
I think a lot of people do it middle of the day. I don't think they wait that long.
There's no end of the day.
Is that would be PUI, right? Photographing under the influence.
Yes. Very
awesome.
Good.
So you take people out there to shoot.
Yeah, we do.
We do, and we love going out ourselves, too. So
we spend a lot of time out there, even without a workshop on our own, just getting out there.
It's right. Really so what are some of the exciting places you've been to?
Well,
the most memorable ones that you've done.
Most memorable? Well, I mean, it's hard to say most memorable we've been to. We always kind of like to get off the beaten path, too, so we're not always...
This is why this is a good fit, because yes. This is off the beaten path photography here.
I mean, we've been to Outer Mongolia. We have two sons that live in Asia, so we do have done a lot of traveling in China and Japan. And we've been India. We love, and we're going back there in November of 13.
I've heard of that, yeah, and there's
great trip.
Actually a chance that I might go there too. So
that'd be unbelievable. It's the most colorful place there is. It just is unique. And the average person that we talk to sometimes has a funny feeling about India, but usually they've heard about it from people that took cruise ships. And there's nothing like getting off a cruise ship and you're at the port and you only see what's around the port.
Which is mostly stuff for tourists, right?
Exactly.
So we really get off away from that and away from the big cities. And even get into the sand dunes and the camels and the sand dunes.
And that is that next year, November 2013, that coincides with a festival there?
Yeah, the Pushkar Camel Festival.
Pushkar. Is that, but that's not the color festival, but where they have like all...
No, that's... in fact, there's a couple pictures of Susan with Holy with the color festival.
We've been there on our own doing that.
That's the Holy Festival.
Yeah, we've been there several times for that.
How do you protect your camera when you do that?
Oh, that's a great one. Actually, you would use anything you use for rain.
Oh, so you have like a Ziploc bag or something around
you have to have something around
filter on the front.
Well, I haven't gone that extreme, but having something around. But usually you just get a rapport with the people around you. Oh, there's Susan. Yeah.
So they threw a color bomb at you.
Yes.
But very nicely. Not
nicely.
Actually,
there's nothing malicious about it. It's
actually, it wasn't thrown. It was more, in fact, there's another picture of maybe the one just before that, if you can get that, Tony. Yeah, and so here the girl was almost asking permission to put it on Susan, and Susan putting it on her.
Do they treat Westerners different than themselves, than each other?
I think to some degree. I think they can tease with each other and maybe do more throwing. And, you know, it depends where you'd be, but just where we chose to be, everything really was fine. Right. I had protection for my camera, but it was regular rain protection.
Okay. Yeah. So nothing over the top?
No, nothing. No. Didn't need it. Didn't need it.
It was great. It was wonderful.
So India 2013. So you travel a lot to that area. Off
Asia,
the world.
But we've been South America a lot,
South America.
Too. And really
anything
pulls at us a lot. It's a wonderful, you know, such different cultures. It's traveling
so
is
what is it for you? Is it the cultures that make you travel? Is it the different views you get, the different kind of look in the architecture, in people, in what makes you want to see these places and photograph them?
All of the things you said, architecture, the people, but
relation light maybe.
Well, good light's good light everywhere, I think, but just relationships with the people. Even when you don't speak the language, you can get relationships with people. And for instance, in India. A lot of times we won't speak the language, but I think a smile is like the thing that gets you to start to be accepted.
Yeah, I had this experience in Kathmandu in Nepal where this pilgrim was praying and doing his rounds around a stupa. All of a sudden I saw this old man waving me over. And at this point I assumed, oh, he wants me to take a photo and then he wants money. Because that sometimes happened there. And he posed for me. He wanted to see the pictures. I showed it to him on the display. He smiled and then went away. And it's like he just gave me the gift of a photo. And that's the thing that
and the
was
experience.
Very amazing in this different culture, that you can have these kind of experiences.
Of course, you know, we teach some classes online with Better Photo. And one of the classes has to do with out-and-about photography, street-type photography.
Right.
So most people, when they start the class, all want to have the longest lens they can get to hide behind a pillar somewhere and take that picture.
Yeah, the paparazzi kind of.
And we approach it like totally different. So we get permission from people first, but that allows us to establish that relationship with them, and we've made really good friends that way. And then after you get permission from the person, and now you're taking the pictures, and maybe they're posing for you, like maybe you want something a little more abstract or something more
natural,
unique, more natural than the posed picture. But after you get that, then you can just, they're going to get bored with you after a while.
Right.
You were unique for a minute. And then they'll go back to what they were doing, and then you can get all the pictures just uh-huh. as natural as what they were doing before.
So you get permission, you do a little mini photo session with them, and then just let them do whatever they want to do, and they
we don't leave right away. Exactly.
I think that's
you don't shoot and run.
You got to be sticky. You got to be there and stick exactly. around for a while. Yeah, right. And then take more than one. I think that's the rule. Take more than one shot, and I guess for a lot of the participants, that is a bit of a therapy session. Like, how do I approach strangers? How do I?
It's difficult for a lot of people, and they're uncomfortable with it. And you know, I think if you're open with what you're doing and you're smiling and right. and you're not trying to sneak, you know, you're just being really open and upfront. Maybe take a picture and show it to them and all. People generally, unless there's a cultural taboo, and that's something, that's a whole different thing. That's, you know, some cultures have, and we respect that when we get into that. But then it becomes a communication, no matter what the language is. And that's what enriches our travels, are these stories like that, and stories like we were in India, I don't know how many years ago, and there was a horrible terrorist bombing, orchestrated one in Bombay. Mm-hmm. We'd had a taxi driver. It was a long story that I'm not going to tell. But we'd met this taxi driver, and he took us to an airport where we flew off to do a little mini tour and come back. And he said he told us he would be back to pick us up. And we got back to the national airport. We had to get over to the international airport. And it was just chaos, absolute chaos. And this policeman said, well, you're going to have trouble getting to the international airport because there was a horrible bombing. He said, nobody's going to be able to get here, no matter what they promised. So I said, well, what are we going to... And he had stored some of our luggage for us. And so we said, well, that's gone. And I said, we better just
wait, try
to get
over. Wait, your luggage was gone?
Well, because what we had left with him to store in a friend's hotel.
Right.
So Neil said, wait a few more minutes. And sure enough, all of a sudden we heard our name. And this man had gone through, I mean, it was like a war zone, to come and get us and take us to the airport because he told us he would. Mm-hmm. And the one thing he wanted was when we got home, he wanted us to phone him that we had gotten home okay.
Oh, wow.
But that was like, 10 years ago, Neil? 10 or 12 years ago. And we went back 2 years ago, and we found him again.
Oh, this is awesome.
We had his card. We had his little business card. It was in Bombay, and we had his business card. And it was just his first name and the taxi standby a hotel. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't there, of course.
He was no longer at that hotel.
Neil Spence.
We got somebody to help us and just...
Concierge, another hotel.
Another hotel, and asked him to help us, and he finally located the guy just before we left, got together with him, and we spent a day with him.
Beautiful.
Amazing day.
My friend John Miller, who set up a few Himalayan treks, photo treks over the last years, he said, you go there for the mountains, but you return for the people. I had this experience, having been to Nepal and Tibet for 3 times, it is really, you build friendships because they take you at face value. They don't judge you by whatever clothes you're wearing or something. And I found the people on that part of the world to really take care of you.
Yeah.
So I've had some really good experiences there too. So
we have them in our own country though too. I mean, we've met people.
Well, where in the U.S. What's the most exciting?
Well, one thing
place in the U.S.
What we love to do is in the beginning I sent some images of how we travel, do a lot of our traveling. So we thought we'd show that because it's
all right.
I don't know there. So we
there
have
we go.
This. Yes, this is our.
is this a camping type thing?
It is.
Looks very very businessy.
So that's how we get around. And the top of that. On the flat part, all raises up. It's a pop-top camper on a flatbed truck.
It was a plumber's truck in its past life. It was full of plumbing equipment, and we pulled that off.
Is there a reason you're doing this? Is this easier to get out in off-road? Or
it's four-wheel drive. We can get off-road. It's got a nice high clearance, but mainly it gives us a lot of storage area.
Don't move away from that. I want to talk about that. So you see that big, large panel on the front, between the cab and the back? That's all storage. So we've been in Alaska for 4 months. We lived in this.
Oh, wow.
And it's like I always say it's like living in a an 8 foot. It's an 8 foot camper. It's like living in a walk-in closet.
That's what
together.
I would
we didn't
that.
Kill each other either. We
wow.
were still friends when we got out of there.
So every now and then, Neil, did you get sent to sleep in the front in the driver's?
No, we've
seat,
been lucky. Or? We've gotten along pretty good on these
have.
Trips. You sort of have to.
But the thing that we always talk about is it says NNS septic tank
service. Yeah, the septic tank business. So what's that for? What's the deal with that?
The deal with that is to hopefully keep anybody who would be curious about what's inside of there out of it.
So it's a
so they
disguise.
Think there's just septic stuff inside.
Okay, so that should probably also let you park in places that you usually don't.
Well,
actually,
I don't know. I mean, I think once or twice we've parked with some trucks like that. But one time we were going into one national park, and the gatekeeper, so to speak, the ranger said, "You can't come in. It's a commercial truck." We said, "No, it's not." And he said, "Yeah, it is." He said, "You can't come in, and it's a magnetic sign." So we just pulled the sign off the door, and he said, "Okay, go ahead."
Oh, wow!
There was Yellowstone. Yeah, I remember that one.
That was fun.
So that truck has saved you some hassle.
And it's created some, too. We've gotten stuck, yeah. It's heavy.
It's pretty unique. And then when we were in the Palouse, one of the first times in the Palouse with it, we were parked on the side of the road, wheat field, and the farmer, we didn't know it, but he was up above on his combine looking down with his binoculars, and he saw the sign, and he came running down because he thought we were going to be dumping sewage
in
his field. But we got to know him, and he's become one of our best friends, and we go back, see him year after year with our workshop groups, and he gets us on land that nobody
we
can go on.
Some private vistas.
It's pretty incredible.
Beautiful.
So we've made friends through that truck.
This truck
just
really
because
does.
It's so unique.
Yeah. In fact, where were we? We were just went in someplace recently, this year. Where was it? I can't even remember. And the guy said, I don't remember you, but I remember your truck.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a little secret tip. So if you ever see a septic thing with a camping thing on the back, it's probably the Silvermans.
You got it.
Okay, so what are the most spectacular places you've shot in the United States?
Oh, well, in the United States, well, some of those pictures. What do you got there, Tony?
Yeah, Tony, show us some of the slides, and we'll just see what we have on there.
Oh, well,
that's not in the United States.
That's the United States of America.
Where is that?
And that's the real moon, and that's Monument Valley.
I get it. Okay.
And we love the Red Rock Country, so we do a lot, lot of tours and workshops in that area, and we love to go there when we have our own time. This is Lake Powell. We do on our Southwest tour, and of course the Antelope Canyons, Slot Canyons.
Mm-hmm.
So the one is the upper antelope. This is in the lower antelope, and they have the light beams that come in there as well. And this is Bryce Canyon that we do on our Southwest tour. And that was just so lovely because you went to bed with no snow and woke up with snow on the ground.
And
by the time I walked out of we walked through the parking lot to get to Vista where we took this picture. And by the time I walked back to the car, there was no snow in the parking lot. I mean, it just melts off of these things
that
fast.
How far up is that?
How far up?
How far up is that?
Well, you're talking 10,000 feet plus, yeah. And this is that was probably in April.
So, yeah, they can get some light snows there.
Wow. So it can be fairly warm weather during the day.
And this is a neat place that we found. We always try, on our workshops,
like
we always try.
Ghost town?
Yes, exactly. We always try to find something that's more than just the iconic places. And this is on the Southwest Tour. And this was the old movie set for Gunsmoke, which...
It's a movie set?
It was.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Gunsmoke, I don't know if you... This is an old classic cowboy
show the problem with movies is in Germany, we have a lot of those old Hollywood movies, but... They have different titles. They give them, they dub them in German, and they give them
different titles.
So I probably know it, but I don't know the title.
Matt Dillon, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was. Matt Dillon.
But anyways, the interesting thing about that is the family owns the property, and they're trying to get a grant to keep it, preserve it, and they're working really hard. And they're very nice. They let us bring our people on to photograph it, and we're giving them a series of images that they can hopefully. get some grant money because it's a historical site.
It's a whole little town there. It's incredible.
So the building is falling apart. Is that part of the movie set?
Yeah.
Is it that old?
That old. It wasn't like that when it was originally.
Oh, so when they shot the movie, it had.
It's all falling apart, and they want to save it and make it a historical site.
A lot of sense.
So we're happy to. We go there almost every year that we're there. It was beautiful, and it's an amazing, amazing fun place. Ooh. And this is the Palouse. We love, we love the Red Rock Country. We love the Palouse. Have you ever been?
I've never been there. No.
Are you familiar with it?
Not really. No.
This is up in Eastern Washington.
Okay.
This is that other Washington.
Which is very strange if you come from Germany.
But Shaquille, we'll talk about the other Washington too.
Yes, he will.
Anyways, that's beautiful area. That's all just these wonderful shapes and hills and textures
at the red and green and the complementary colors there and the way the light falls and wow. And
I mean, light, texture, shape, form, everything we dream about.
Everything's there in this picture.
And it's all dry farmed, so there's no irrigation wheels, and no, it's all just whatever the natural rain is. So it's all very natural. What you see there has been, of course, plowed and planted. And
I'm just trying to get a sense of the scale. It's very hard on this picture.
Any
reference in there?
Well, you're looking at miles and miles to those far mountains in the back.
But they're not necessarily all high. There's some kind of buttes there. They call it Steptoe Butte and Kamiak Butte, and they're probably the elevation is, a couple thousand to 2,000 maximum that you can get up and get this overview of. But every time of year you go there, it's different. And they plant all the different wheat. And that farmer we talked about who thought we were dumping all of our sewage into the land when he ran down and then we become close friends. His grandfather began the lentil, and it's a big area for growing lentils, and his grandfather was a farmer there, and a German minister was riding through that back in the 1800s and handed his grandfather a handful of lentil seeds and said, try planting this.
That's what founded
it's one of their major
crops.
It's
the premier lentils coming out of here, and their wheat goes to Asia. They have premier wheat too, but it goes all to Japan.
Mostly
basically.
To Japan because they use that.
So, Tony, can we go back to this previous shot? Just a question. The light has a direction, it has a quality, it has a color, which pretty much makes me ask you the question, how important is the timing? When do you get out to take these kind of pictures? I know a lot of landscape photographers will get up at 4 a.m. to get these pre-sunrise shots and things.
We don't worry about pre-sunrise too much, but when the first light just comes across those crests, it's absolutely beautiful. And at sunset it is also.
So the light just skims along
right
the
across the
landscape.
Yeah. And the next shot also is in that Palouse area.
Totally different.
This is totally different because this is during the harvest time. Uh-huh. So this is more August-y.
Yeah.
And the other was more May, June. Our workshops we do in the beginning of June, and middle of June up there every year. But these scenes like this are everywhere, and they love to have clouds up there. And even if you have a little storm, it's usually just a little one. So it's like, the cat's meow for us.
So is it stable from a light point of view? I know that sometimes you have these, like this, for example, you have lots of clouds that move very fast, and then the light changes every 2 minutes.
It would be hard to do panoramics at certain times when the wind's blowing.
Unless you have like seven cameras set up.
No, but I did a pano this year that is a real favorite of mine. And I used something that I haven't used before, so I'm just starting to use the Gigapan.
Oh, like an automated
automated robotic little digital
I've seen those, yeah.
Computer. And we just did one with 68 pictures the other day. That's like on the low scale.
Yeah.
But by having a telephoto lens in there, you can go in and blow this thing up time after time.
So all of a sudden you have several hundred megapixels from...
No, actually... 2 gigabytes?
Two gigabytes.
2.5 gigabyte files, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to learn how to live with that right now. But it's been a lot of fun, and we did just do one in the Palouse, and it worked out just wonderful. In fact,
look at this.
It's on the Gigapan website right now.
This is one of those, again, one of those light skimming.
The light skimming.
So do you use any, I mean, the light is obviously of the essence, because you have very different looks depending on what time of day, what time of year. Do you have a database that you keep, like, times when the light is good where, or do you use any tools to help you, any websites, anything else?
You know, we're not that technical, but I know the place real well, and I know if I walk out of the motel in the morning and look at the sky, I sort of know where to go.
Okay, so you just it's just the experience. That
experience, helps you. Because if it's getting cloudy in a certain area, I'll know what my choices are.
Right.
So I do have that advantage over anybody. You can have technical everything for kind of knowing where the light's coming from. And we do have on our iPad, we have little applications that'll tell us where the light's coming up and things like that. But that's pretty much experience for a place like this.
Yeah. Right. So knowing the place helps a lot.
Very much there. Yeah, absolutely.
And we always, you know, with our workshops, we do that. We always get where we're going early. I mean, we've always scouted. We know.
That helps.
I mean, a lot, because it's not, you know, we get people up early to leave at 4 a.m. and
so you leave it, so you get up at like 3 a.m. to leave at 4 a.m. Wow.
Sometimes it
I'm a night owl.
Light.
I think I would probably still be up at that time.
Well, then you'd be good to go.
So what's the main difference? I mean, the sun comes up and it goes down. What's the main difference in light between dusk and dawn? How do they differ?
You know, that's a great, that really is a great question. Up there, it would be what direction you're going to be taking the photograph.
So obviously, you have the sun coming from the other side.
So
in the evening.
You want to make your choices of where to go so that you're not, for us, usually not looking directly into the sun. I like it coming from the side a lot of the times. But there's times where we do it both ways. I mean, one of your favorite places you mentioned, I just heard you as I was waiting to come in, was Canyonlands.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And, you know, if somebody goes to Mesa Arch, they're looking right into the sun.
Right.
But even there, the knowledge of knowing what time to be there and when to stay and not leave right away. Because sometimes that sun's right at you and right in your camera, and then all of a sudden it's behind the arch. And now you can take all the shots.
All of a sudden it turns into this beautiful
shot. So most of these things are pretty much local knowledge things, yeah.
All right, so let's have a look at a few more pictures. Look at this.
The other thing about this about the Palouse area is there are these wonderful old barns, but the a lot of the farmers, as they fall down, they're just letting them go.
This is another one of these RGB type. I call these RGB pictures. They have red, green, and blue, like primary colors, very strong, very simple, but seemingly simple. But then you have these beautiful color contrasts in there, and this. The sky pretty much takes up all the pictures. So.
Well, this is a great place because there's a bunch of wonderful horses right here. And so we just did a workshop up there a few months ago, and everybody just had a ball with the horses after they got their landscape shot. So
it's a variety thing.
Yeah.
So what do you use for taking these kind of shots? Do you have any secret sauce, any secret ingredients, any gear that you like most? I mean, I'm a fan of the 24 tilt shift. That is, for me, this is a beautiful lens that works in so many contexts.
You know, the 24 tilt shift is as good as it gets for us. It's pretty special.
It's this crispness, and it's got this versatility
absolutely.
And everything.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And even without the tilt or the shift, it's a wonderful lens.
Yes.
I mean, it's just sharp as could be. We're pretty much wide angle on those types of shots.
All right.
So,
but landscape doesn't have to be wide angle.
No.
There are opportunities, because I see that sometimes photographers go, oh, landscape, let me get the 17 millimeter. And then they get this shot that doesn't have any landscape on it because it's all so far away, you know, and it's just foreground and the background so far away. So some of those landscape shots will work with a 50 millimeter. If someone has like a simple entry level 51.8, you can get a lot of these things.
Well, the 51.4 is the thing we ask people to think about getting. If they're ever asking us about lenses and giving us all these choices, we'll usually say get that 51.4 if the money's a problem, a 51.8. But for like the Nikon area, about $300 will get you.
Yes.
And you can get a used one. There isn't much to go wrong on these lenses. They're very simple. There aren't tons of elements. They're not long, get banged up all the time.
Right.
So there's places to get like a used 51.4, put it on your camera, don't even take it off for a couple months, and just go everywhere with it. Mm-hmm. And it makes it so easy because it's small and light.
It'll teach you a lot about photography. It misses that, I always find it misses that wow effect. You know, if you take a super wide angle and you go, whoa, this is so cool, or a long telephoto. But this 50 is so normal. It's so in the middle. It's so...
It's the way we see.
Yeah, it doesn't really do any of that effect stuff. So it's a very true lens. It takes pictures that are very real.
But
very
it's fast.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
They learn how to get depth of field and how to get things in and out of focus.
Yes.
You know, so everybody's looking at the internet all the time for everywhere they go. They've all got Google images now to look at, and they can see 200,000 pictures of the place they're going to in an instant.
That's actually a good tip.
So now we have to do something that's unique and different.
Yeah, but for scouting, I think that's a good idea to look look on Street View or on different websites that have geotagging. Like Flickr has geotagged pictures. You can bring up a map and see the pictures that have been taken there and get an idea what's possible there. So I think that will probably simplify the scouting process a bit.
It does.
And then this is White Sands National
Where's that?
Monument.
New Mexico.
So we go there in November.
What time of day is that?
That's early morning.
It's early morning before sunrise?
Just before sunrise, and that is the type of color you get there.
This is amazing.
Yeah, and then I think there's a couple more in there, but I like to go, I love this shot, but I love the shot in black and white too, but any kind of form, pattern, texture, and then they have some cactuses there.
Some of those landscape shots are very graphical, very, very simple shapes. I mean, this is just a two-part picture. And those two parts are very, very distinctive, and the way the sky looks, as opposed to the structure of the sand in the front.
And this is with a 24 tilt shift.
I figured
I haven't had it that many years. And,
I bought mine used from an architecture photographer for like $500. And I was lucky to get it at that price, and it's beaten up, and it's getting slightly strange, but it's still one of my favorite lenses. And I like to use it not shifted and not tilted, because then it's just super sharpest lens you can get. Even though the sharpness part, if you don't know how to take an exciting picture, you can have the most expensive lens and it will still not be an exciting picture.
That's amen.
That's what workshops are for.
You got it. This here is right near there. So you're asking where that is? This is just a few hours away from the White Sands.
So very different.
So what a place to go in
New Mexico.
And this is a telephoto lens now. This is not a wide
telephoto lens. And we do a couple days here and then a couple days at the other place at White Sands. Yeah.
This is in the migration path of the cranes, the sandhill cranes.
So did you have to wait a long time to make them show up, or are there just so many of them?
No, there's tens, there's probably 30,000 of these snow geese there.
Oh,
and probably,
look at that.
5,000-8,000 of those big ones.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
all right.
No, so. This is all day long.
At night they roost, and then in the morning they lift off like that. If they hear something threatens them or somebody, they get an instant message.
Yes.
Time to take off. And
but the photographer has to be on his toes, because you're there and they're all on the ground and it seems like nothing's going to happen. And a coyote comes over and scares them off, and then they just lift off like that.
And you got to be ready.
The sound
is
amazing. And so a lot of people go just because of these big birds, but these are red-winged blackbirds there. And so we love to have these opportunities. And it really gives people a chance to do things with slow shutter speeds and work with any kind of lens there.
Have you been to Newfoundland? William Follett on Twitter asked, Silverman should come to Newfoundland. They'd love the scenery.
I know.
More so the
that
people
is
here.
That is something we really want to do, and we've not made it there. But we're really, that's
it's on
so
the list.
Funny. It is. It's just something we've always talked about going to.
Yeah, that side of the globe I haven't been to yet, so.
Well, we've frequently done things in Maine in October for the color change.
So to go to
Newfoundland then would be, just on our way there would be incredible.
In our truck.
And it works out, the timing works out pretty well too for being able to do both. So we're looking forward to doing that, yeah.
Very cool. Oh, wow.
This is just a few weeks ago in our way back from...
A friend calls us the philosopher.
So you he looks like a thinker, yeah? So you combine the landscape and the wildlife thing if it
Well, this
it
is
happens.
Pretty much a landscape trip, but you always have to be aware because there's lots of wildlife out there.
So when you're on a landscape shoot, how long would you be out there shooting and how many pictures would you return home?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we'd start out early because up there... the light just breaks through very, very early.
So you have this phase where night turns to day and light mm-hmm. changes very quickly. So
yeah,
you know
the June workshops, like the June places, like Palouse or like going to Banff in June.
Up in Canada.
You're talking
Banff,
about,
like
you're pretty far north. And so sunset maybe 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And sunrise maybe 5 o'clock in the morning, that type
or
of thing, quarter to 5. And then you've got to get there. From wherever you're going, but the light when it comes through those mountains, I'm telling you, it's worth it.
It's worth getting up early.
It's worth it. Yeah.
People forget about their coffee real fast. They don't.
Excited about the picture.
They start a little bit of whining about is there any place to get coffee, but then they forget that immediately. It's a long gone.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful, but we ran into some wonderful bears.
So
on
these
this
are
nice
all
trip.
These are both just on this trip. And, you know, without having to hike in a long ways or kill yourself to do it, these were right by the road type of thing.
Wow. The dandelions were out, and they were these big grizzly bears love to eat dandelions. You know that? The
yes.
yellow flowers?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's so funny to me.
But it's wonderful to find some specimens that don't have a collar. Some of them have big yellow collars and tags
right.
and all that stuff. And we found these guys that were just...
Would you go in and whatever, Photoshop a tag out or something?
Would I? Under the right circumstances, I would, sure. Yeah.
It's the picture that counts.
But we're trying to identify it if we do it. If we do that, then we're saying we were doing it.
Right.
But, yeah, I don't like to see all that on the bears. But, you know, for the most part, if I saw one with a lot of collar and tag and everything, I'm not going
to
stick around, for me, a long time and
to
take a lot of shots of it.
Maybe to watch them.
But... somebody who hasn't done this a lot, I would think they would
it's
be doing it.
Subject.
Yeah, because, you know, we've done this for years and years and years, so we're going to look for the specimen that, you know, that we want to spend time with. And we were very lucky because this is in gorgeous light. This was, like, just before sunset.
So Hamburg came on the chat, asked, he's thinking, are these photographers my breakfast? What do you do to stay safe?
We're smart. I mean, we don't. You know, and especially when we have people with us, we're very careful to be, you know, not
so you have to
be
keep
foolish.
Your distance and maybe shoot stuff like that from the car and be...
Or if you get out of your car, be ready to get back in because they are wild animals. I mean, you can't... They look like they're not...
They look nice and cuddly, right?
And they look like they're not paying... You're not offending them or threatening them, but you never know, you know. You just don't. So we have great respect when we're around anything like that.
Right.
No foolish...
Oh, look at that wine
country.
That's where you are right now.
This is Sonoma?
This is right around here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right around Petaluma.
Yeah.
So this is...
look at this.
And that's close to where we live.
So, you know, the fun thing is that some people feel they have to travel far and really go away to get great pictures. But, you know, we
right
maintain no matter where you are. I mean, it's true we're blessed to be in this lovely area, but... We know people that they come to our workshops from where they are that you might think is not a destination travel place, but they have some beautiful images, you know, and it's how you see it and how you...
Now, this is the fog above the landscape.
That's what makes this wine so great around here, really. I mean, that's why it's as
the
famous
humidity.
As it is. Yeah, we get this kind of thing mornings, evenings.
Uh-huh. And then it helps to live here because you get a better feeling about what the weather's going to be like and when the fog comes in and when it leaves again or when you can actually use it for a photo and make use of it.
Yeah,
because sometimes I drove up Highway 1 yesterday and there were places where I looked out onto the sea and it's like, oh, this is beautiful and there's nice composition, but then fog in and it's just completely gone all of a sudden.
Yeah, coming in and going out of the fog. Really is some great photo opportunities here.
I think so.
I love to photograph the fog.
So if you are right at the edge where the fog starts coming in, I've seen some really amazing like blankets of fog coming over the mountain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like this. It's got a body. It's got something very physical, as if you could like touch it.
Yeah. It's so, quite an experience south of San Francisco there.
Yes, and it's cold in San Francisco in August.
Yeah, yeah, it's our winter.
Unexpected when you don't know that.
I know.
I think lots of tourists come here and freeze to death.
It happened to me originally, and I mean that's a long time ago. But I had to get a winter jacket the first thing I did.
When did you move here?
Well, that's 40 years ago.
40 years ago.
In the 70s, yeah. But, you know, people just don't realize. You just don't think it's going to be so cold.
And, yeah.
But then it can turn around and be beautiful, too. So
it's very...
But we're probably 30 degrees changing. Difference than San Francisco right now.
Yeah. Up here, it's warm, yeah. Up here, it's really warm. Down in San Francisco, yeah, you need a jacket. All right, so... Oh, wow, look at this.
So this is all around here. This is Sonoma County.
So it doesn't really take... A lot of it doesn't
take
a lot
of. We
love
to get out with the workers, and we know a lot of the foremen. We've connected with the harvesters, nice. The foremen, and the men that work in the fields, and we go back every year, and we're invited to their parties at the end when they have their wrap up parties when they've finished all the harvest.
That is hard work.
Oh, it's
and
very
most of,
hard.
Most of that is still manual labor.
Yeah. Some of them have...
look at these hands.
Yeah, some of them have the machines, but it's still mainly a manual labor.
So, question from the chat. Mart asks, what about the cameras used? What kind of a camera? You don't shoot film anymore.
We shot 4x5 film until not too long ago, but I haven't been doing that. And with the tilt-shift lens, that's helping a little bit.
So you get some of what the 4x5 gives you with the movements and everything.
A little bit of movement.
Yeah.
But it's still more limited than the 4x5.
Right.
I mean, that movement on the 4x5 was pretty much incredible. And some of my favorite pictures that I've ever taken. And we're Nikon people for the most part. I have Canon for my infrared camera.
Uh-huh. Which one is that?
I have a Canon T3i that has been converted by Life Pixel.
Oh, so you had the infrared filter taken out of it?
Yes.
Okay.
A little bit of what you were talking about just as we were waiting to come in. And love that because that extends the whole day for us.
Infrared gives you a lot of times where you couldn't really shoot good
pictures. Just extends the day. If you were on a travel trip with a tour group, and they were going to a great place at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in bright sun, and the color and contrast, everything was horrible for everything else. That is the greatest time to take infrared black and white.
Right.
So we love it. And it's small. I just have one little lens on it. I have a 15-85 on it.
Uh-huh.
I never take it off, and it just does the job.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I love black and white infrared. I think there may be some in here. Well, the one of that ghost town. Shot was
that was infrared,
black and white infrared.
Oh yeah, the sky was pretty dark, so the sky doesn't have much infrared.
But in that, the sky goes black for the most part.
Yeah,
and then we just did a sepia treatment of the bottom of it. Yeah.
All right. So the Canon. Oh, here's the shot again. Oh, it's not a color shot.
So it's black and white with just a sepia treatment on the bottom.
And the sepia works really well with the subject.
Yeah,
it's really have a very good fit here. So the Canon for infrared, and then the rest is
all other stuff is Nikon gear.
All Nikon stuff.
So it's just kind of what we know.
Just DSLRs.
Yes.
Uh-huh. All right. And a 24 tilt shift.
Yeah, I love it. And we're starting to do more with the panoramics. I'm really
the GigaPen. What kind of GigaPen is that? The GigaPens come in different sizes.
They have two different ones that I know about. The one we have is called the Epic Pro, and it handles our larger professional SLR body.
It takes a bigger DSLR.
It takes the heavier weight.
Yeah.
And they've been a great company to work with. I'm just enjoying it. It's a whole new thing for us.
Beautiful. Very nice. So, where would people find out a bit more about you in the workshops?
Well, we have our workshops listed, and we're just getting our 13 schedule up, but it's on our website, which is silvermansphotography.com.
Silvermansphotography.com.
Plural. Mm-hmm.
Silvermans.
You got it.
Okay. Two I think it should be on the screen. Oh, here's the website. Okay. Yeah. So that's where people can find out and take a class, take a trip to a beautiful location with you guys and have great pictures. So thank you so much for coming here.
Thanks. Well, this is great.
Neil, it was great having you.
Very nice.
Susan,
thank you
so much.
Thank you. All right. Enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you. Okie dokie. So that was it for this segment.
All right.
Beautiful stuff.
Good.
Really like it. So I will answer questions for another, I don't know, it's 5:30, another 20 minutes. I'll be answering questions. If you want to stick around, you can. If you
Neil's got
if you need to take your
with a
gig,
saxophone.
You play the saxophone.
Yeah.
What kind of music?
This is kind of a blues type of thing.
Blues R&B. Well, have fun.
Party in Sebastopol.
So
come over when you get there.
I actually have a photo session right after this.
All right.
It's already planned. A portrait session. Okay. See you. Thanks again for coming. Okie dokie. So this is photo day, and we are. I'm gonna do another Q&A. So let's look at the chat now. You guys have questions? Let me know. And Tony, we haven't heard from Paul anymore, right? So he's not here. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
All right. No, it's okay. I've just if he wanted to come on, if he said he would be a bit later, we could still do it. But then then you guys want to take off too, right? So let's see. Questions from the chat. What's the capital of Iceland? I don't know. Ask me. No photo questions, please. Mr. John Arnold from the UK. What about pocketable cameras? Mart asking, which one do you have when you're not carrying the DSLR around? Well, pocket cameras, I'm still shooting with an old Panasonic LX3 that I've had for a long time. It's a 10 megapixel camera. It's still fairly good. But to be honest, most of the time, it's an iPhone. You can do some amazing stuff with an iPhone nowadays. So that has taken over just from a convenience point of view, and because the big picture quality is typically good enough. So I think they call it iPhoneography, which is a very weird term. What ASA would you use to shoot a black cat at night? Ha ha ha. Well, you know, you use a high ISO, you use a lens like a 50 1.8 or a 50 1.4, and then you learn how to expose really well in this way. Actually, let me move this camera out of the way so I can see the chat better. Do you need physical filters anymore since so much software can duplicate the effects? Web5130 asked that. Physical filters, yes, I do use physical filters, especially two types of filters. I do not use a UV filter or a skylight filter. These are all important for the analog world. But what I use is a polarizer. Polarizer is a very useful filter when it comes to dealing with reflections. You'd have like water surfaces where you can take out the reflection or get more saturation in landscape shots, for example. A lot of the greenery reflects light from the sky. So you have the blue light from the sky coming in, bouncing off the green leaves. And with a polarizer, you can pretty much turn those reflections off. So you would end up with more green and with more saturated colors in landscape. So this is the one filter. The other is the ND grad filter. An ND grad filter is a graduated neutral density filter. It's pretty much the same as your front window in the car. On the top, it's dark, and then it has this gradient, and then it goes to transparent. And this kind of a filter you can use to take down the brightness of a sky. So the upper half of the picture where the sky would be too bright, you can darken that down, and then you have a much more even exposure in landscape photos. And the third one is an ND filter, neutral density filter. It's like sunglasses for your camera. So you would end up with with less light on the sensor that can help you in, for example, in bright sunlight, where the camera would typically have to use a very low ISO, a very short shutter speed, and a very small aperture. So the small aperture gives you that everything in focus feeling on a picture. And if you want to have selective focus, you have to open up the aperture a bit more. But in very bright sunlight, that might not be possible because the camera is kind of at the end of what it can do. So you would use an ND filter to bring down the light, and then this will allow you to open up the aperture a bit further. It will also allow you to use a longer shutter speed. So you can, for example, have during daytime do like several second exposures to get flowing water that you wouldn't be able to get without an ND filter. So it's ND, ND grad, and polarizer. These are the three filters that I think are still valuable because you cannot really duplicate their effects in software, at least only partially. Everything else, everything that's color related, is not a problem. Infrared is not a problem because digital cameras have infrared filters built in, so they're not an issue. Sean Galbraith, I don't believe you. $5 UV filters. I know this person because I'll be holding a workshop with him next weekend. In Toronto, this is the large format workshop. 4x5 film, large format, sold out. The week after next week, the weekend after next weekend, is another workshop in Toronto that will hold, and it's the Toronto Urban Photography Workshop. If you're interested in cityscapes, people photography, architecture, everything, even some urban decay, that'll be a good workshop. So if you're interested, there are actually a few spots open on that. Starts on the 31st of August. So you're in Toronto? Might be interesting. White Noise asks, how did the invisible camera work out for you? Well, I can't find it anymore. It's invisible. It's gone. check invisible. I think it's theinvisiblecamera.com. It's a video on there from a while ago. And it's a funny little video. Dragonfly, night star shots, what ISO is best? Ooh, that's a very good question. If you want to shoot stars, you probably can't have a longer shutter speed than 10 to 15 seconds. Everything beyond that will turn these stars into star streaks because, well, the Earth is moving under the sky, so the stars in relation to the Earth move. So you want to keep the shutter speeds shorter, and that kind of dictates how high you set the ISO. Pretty much you have to find a balance there or use some software that allows you to stack multiple exposures. So you can take multiple short exposures and stack them on top of each other, and then this way kind of add the exposures from the different shorter shots. Let's see, more questions. No, Sean, true professionals do not use Starburst filters for all of their shots. No, no, no. Don't believe this person. Let me see if there's anything new coming in on Twitter. No new questions. Have I worn you out? Polarized lenses? Polarized lenses. Never heard of a polarized lens, even though there's usually a bit of polarization going on there. TIFF or JPEG? Raw. That's my answer. Raw, raw, raw. No, Sean, you never lie. Geek Girl, where can you go to book Toronto? Very good question. DiscoverTheTopFloor.com. That's where you find the workshops. DiscoverTheTopFloor.com. And there's like a lot of them. So the North American ones are there. Next year, end of January, Hokkaido, Japan is going to be fun. And if you're in Germany, well, at this time, it's 5:40. It's 2:40. It's almost 3 o'clock in Germany. So probably none of the German viewers is on. Anyone from Germany still on? Hello? Who made it this long? Lop Detron. If I like HDR. If it's good HDR, absolutely. There's HDR where HDR is used as an effect, as a, this painting kind of style. I'm not a real fan of that. But then there's HDR where you use it to expand the dynamic range and get more detail in the shadows without introducing lots of noise. Lightroom 4 is actually really good at that. If you have several shots of the same scene with high contrast and you drop those into Lightroom 4, no, actually not those. You have to make an HDR picture, a 32-bit TIFF file out of those, and then you drop them into Lightroom, and all of a sudden you have the exposure slider that normally goes from +3 or +5 to -5 now has a range of +10 to -10 stops. So it's a huge range, and you can get this HDR without having the HDR effect kind of look, but it's going to look very natural, and you can still cover that entire range without introducing halos or strange colors and things. Those pictures, those newer type of HDRs are more, I like those a lot more. Sean says, the painting style HDR, he calls that rainbow clown vomit. Yeah, I can agree with that to a certain extent. Do you think HDR is an overused method? Well, there's a lot of HDR out there, and a lot of it I don't really like for that reason, because it's one of those things that is just very very predominant in some places right now. What do you think about the mirrorless cameras, and will this be the end of DSLRs? Hot milk. Oh, it's Tony. I recognize that. That's a very good question. So the new mirrorless cameras, I think, have a chance to take over to a certain extent, especially when we look at the systems that integrate well. Again, good example is the recently announced Canon M system, which is going to have a different mount, but you can adapt existing Canon lenses to it, and it has an APS-C sensor, so a Canon crop sensor. And so you can use all your existing big lenses and put them on this very small camera. But you can also put like small lenses on there, M-mount lenses, that will then make it a very pocketable camera, but at the expense of all the dials. So you will you won't be able to directly access all the different modes. I mean, on this camera, it's very easy to switch between the different modes, and then I have buttons here and buttons here, and on the back I have this thumb wheel to access thing and a little joystick, and on these newer cameras you have much less of that, and Canon is instead putting a touchscreen in there. So it will be different from the handling, not as direct access. There it is, USM with a 22 millimeter pancake lens as a kit. Is there a price there? Oh, that's the official Canon site, but this is too small for me to read from here. It's like $800, right? Yeah. Okay, $800, $800. So we're it's not cheap, but from what I heard, this is pretty much a Canon Rebel T3i in a smaller package. So the processor and the sensor are apparently very similar. GoPro Hero 2, good action camera, question by Dragonfly. I haven't tried it, but I've seen good results from it. It's definitely one of the versatile cameras when it comes to action, and you can clamp it to your helmet or to your bike or to the end of a pole or something by. And you can get shots that you would typically not be able to get. Now, I'm not sure what the actual resolution is on those So I don't think it compares to like 21 megapixels, but it is going to get you shots and video, especially video, from areas that are hard to get or sometimes impossible to get with other cameras. And I think it also comes with a watertight housing, so you can take underwater shots. And if you've if you've seen the prices of underwater housings for DSLRs, they are quite high in price. So it's definitely a good option if you have issues with dirt or water. Mart, why have they stripped off the LCD on top of the cameras? I cannot understand it. Well, this has an LCD on top. Here it is. Here we go. And I think the higher level cameras, the more expensive ones still have that. And the cheaper ones, I think it's just a factor to save money. So they moved a lot of this stuff onto the display in the back. And I think it's, yeah, I think it's just a way to keep the price down. Any thoughts on the Nikon 18 to 300 millimeter lens, using it with my D80? Well, I don't know the lens. I haven't shot with it, so I can't really tell you anything. But 18 to 300 is a huge range. So lenses, zoom lenses that cover such an enormous range, typically that comes at a price. And it's very often it's the price of image quality. So you have issues with image quality, especially at the long and at the wide end of this focal range. And sometimes that is very typically the focal lengths that are mostly going to be used on these lenses. So if you have an 18 to 300, it's very likely that you take a lot of shots at 18, a lot of at 300, and not that many in the middle. And those ends of the spectrum are the ones that have the worst quality in pretty much any zoom lens. Most zoom lenses are pretty good somewhere in the middle, and they drop off at the beginning and at the end of the range. And you can spend a lot to get a lens that is really, really good at pretty much the entire range. That is usually reflected in the price. So these lenses with a huge range at a lower price, they typically have a very small sweet spot that is somewhere in the middle and at a certain aperture, and there they're really, really good. But as soon as you leave that range, that medium range, you will end up with a drop off in image quality. But then again, it's not always about the quality of the about the sharpness, about the contrast. Sometimes it's just about what's in the picture, and if that is exciting, then I'm usually good with a bit less image quality. Have you tried any large format digital web 853? Are they much better than 34? No, I haven't tried a large format digital camera because there aren't really any large format digital cameras. Well, this is large format. So this is the size, this inner box here, this is the size of a negative in the large format world. And they just don't build sensors at this size. What they do is they're scanning backs. So you can put those on a large format camera and you have this line scanning down, but depending on the resolution, that'll take a while, so you can't shoot anything that is moving. And it's also not really cheap. Medium format digital. There's medium format comes in two flavors, and it's not just the different technology, analog and digital, but analog and digital medium format also come at different sizes of the sensor. So the analog medium format is typically 6 by 4.5 centimeters, or 6 by 6, or 6 by 7, or 6 by 9. So it's always the 6 centimeter width, which is the width of this 120 film, the roll film that you use for it. And the digital medium format is it's quite a bit smaller. So so I haven't really used that. Leica S2, I've played with a Leica S2. I've played with that 4 years ago at Photokina. Quite a heavy camera. Simon House says, medium format is a dying format right now. Nobody making any newer sensors. Well, that might be the case. And if it's just about the megapixels, you might be right there. If you look at the 36 megapixels of the D800, There's actually a video out there on YouTube. I don't know who made it, but it's a shootout between Hasselblad, I think it is, and a digital Hasselblad and D800 that are in a similar megapixel range. And the amount of pixels is one thing, but the size of the sensor is another thing, because you will get different depth of field with a different size sensor. That's one of the reasons I'm still completely in love with 4x5, is that you have a very different feeling to the pictures, because you have much more control over depth of field, and you can get shallow depth of field even in situations where another camera, DSLR, might not be able to do that. So it's not just about the size of the sensor. Now, if that is enough to make the manufacturers come up with new medium format sensors, I don't know. Web8553, what do you think about the new Leica 10 coming out? Well, I'm not even sure that it has been announced officially yet. I think we'll have to wait for Photokina for this. I don't know. I mean, Leica does some interesting stuff. They are they have the Leica M monochrome, which which is the second monochrome camera on the market, just made for the purpose of shooting pictures. There's the first one is a medium format back made by Phase One, and then Leica did the same thing. They pretty much ripped off the RGB, the Bayer array, the filter array in front of a color sensor, and now every single pixel, there's no interpolation anymore, no demosaicing process. It's every single picture counts, every single pixel counts, and you end up with a raw file that has every single pixel at full dynamic range. And I think that is a pretty amazing thing, especially if you are into black and white photography, and if you are into more purity in photography. And as I said earlier, in analog photography, by shooting analog or by shooting a Leica M monochrome, you pretty much take away options, and that is going to make you commit to one kind of photography, and that'll make it a pretty different animal. So it's one of the reasons I love to shoot black and white, for example. It's just, and black and white on film. So I make a choice, I stick to it, and I will get better results for that. But then I wouldn't want to afford a Leica M monochrome at this point, because I don't know how much it is, like 8,000 or 9,000 bucks. Why haven't I upgraded to the 5D Mark III? Isn't it much better than the 5D Mark II? Yeah, it's a better camera. It has better autofocus. I think it does. It has better ISO performance, even though the 5D Mark II has a very good ISO performance, and even the movie mode in there works really well for me. At this point, I've played with a Mark III, but if I were still on a 5D Mark I, I would be interested in the 5D Mark III. But at this point, I don't think that the jump is enough. Well, it's clearly not enough for me to upgrade at this point. What do you think of the Nikon D3200? Haven't played with it, so I'm pretty sure for the price it's a very capable camera. By the way, about the question, what's better, Canon or Nikon or Sony or Olympus? And I get this a lot. First of all, go try them out. Go to a camera store and try them out. Play with the menu system. Play with all the details. Try to find out if it works for you. And they are very different systems. And here's a tip I got from my friend Gary in San Francisco a couple of years ago. And he said, you want to take the camera that your friends have. You want to take the brand that your friends have, because then you can interchange lenses. You can exchange lenses and accessories, and you'll be able to help each other out with different things and experiment together, which I think is also a very good thing. No, Sean, I'm not going to answer this question. What's better, Chamonix or Shenhao? Well, we'll be spending next week shooting with with three different types of large format cameras. The field camera that you saw here on the photo day, that's a foldable camera that you can take into the field. Then there are the so-called monorails, which are more studio-based large format cameras. So they have this rail system where everything is mounted to, and they're quite heavy. And Monica is going to come over to Toronto, and she will bring her Graflex, Graflex Crown Graphic, which is a press camera. So this is a foldable type of field camera, but it's more suited to rapid fire shooting. Well, as rapid as you can get with a large format camera. So we'll have different types of cameras here and different stuff to play with. Web 5049, after all, what was the live event all about? Photography. This was all about shooting with analog, digital, with large, medium, small format, 35 millimeters, and all that stuff. Yeah, what do you think of the Nokia PureView camera and its technology? So what Nokia did is they have a 40-ish megapixel camera in a small phone, and they bin those pixels together. So they reduce the size by adding multiple pixels together and combining their output, and this way getting a noise-free or a less noise picture of 5 megapixels. So that is a new technology, and I think the major advantages of this technology are in the zooming. So you can actually zoom to different levels on the sensor, and that is going to be helpful in video and these kind of applications. I haven't really seen results from there yet, so I'd have to try it out. But it's pretty interesting technology. I think we'll probably see a bit more in the future. Thank you, Heinz, for the nice feedback. Where do you get your iPhone apps? Well, off the iPhone App Store. I'm not jailbroken, so. 3 a.m. in Germany, time to go to bed. Yep. Good night, Hamburg Cam. Sleep well. Oh, who was the guest that didn't make it? White Noise asks that question. It's a guy from Toronto who does tintype photography. And it's actually interesting technology. There's this thing on the blogs lately where someone did... Let me find that. Tintype iPhone 4. So what is tintype photography? Tintype photography is photography technology from 1851. That's when it was developed. And what they do is... the other name is wet plate collodion photography. So it's a technology that works with a wet plate. So they have these kind of backs, and then you put a sensitized plate in there. It's a wet plate, and it has to be wet to be exposed. And then you put that, and it can be a glass plate or a metal plate. That's why it's called tintype. But it could be a glass plate. And what someone did is they bought a new glass back for their iPhone 4S, and you know that you can pretty simply replace that. So he bought one that is a very... and I'm still trying to find this. Here we go. I got it. So, Tony, if you can pull up my screen. You can't see my screen? Let me see. Can I move it over? Okay, now I'm not seeing it, but I'll have to guess it. Okay, so let me resize that. I'm kind of... I can't see this side of the screen. Okay, so what he did is he used a glass back that he bought, like a third-party thing, without a logo on it. And then here's what he does. He cleans it up, and he coats it. He coats it with this collodion and puts it inside one of those one of those backs, so it pretty much exposes directly onto that glass plate. And then if you go back to the website, you can get an idea of what this looks like, with the contrast and everything. So this is a photo exposed on the back of an iPhone, and it is a one-of-a-kind thing. That's the nice thing about this photography. It's 1850s technology, but it has such beautiful contrast, and the warmth in those pictures is amazing. So you, this is a unique bag. You can't repeat that. It's a very, very interesting thing. Pipkin asks, is that the process Sally Mann has been using? I don't know. But you can find this under a different name. So if you try Wet Plate Collodion, and there should be some Wikipedia entries. It's also known as Embrotype, I think, and Tintype. So these are the names for it. So let me see. Chris, you seem really relaxed and seem to be enjoying yourself. You look like a young Leo. I don't know if that's a compliment or not. No, I take it as such. I think I'm relaxed pretty much because I'm still on a very different time zone. So my brain is just flooded with endorphins. So I'm it's like all these weird things in my brain right now, and I'm jet lagged. So that's probably why. 6 o'clock. Tony, how long can I keep going? When do you want to go home?
Well, Leo's radio show is at 11 tomorrow.
So. Leo's radio show is at 11. Well, let's add another 5 minutes and then call it a day. So if you have any last questions, I'm not getting invited back next year. Sean, that's not true. It's just getting good now. All right. 4 a.m., Germany. Mart, gute Nacht. Sleep well. If I was at home, I'd be fast asleep by now. I'm not sure. I'm a night owl. Time for bed here in the UK. Chris, what generation is your iPad? It's an iPad 3. It's a new one. Do you run courses in London? Big Ginge or Jing? Actually, I'm looking at coming to the UK in 2013, next year. So at this point, I'm looking at one, maybe two, or maybe even three workshops in the UK. So one will be around London, probably not in the central. It's really funny. I asked this question, should I do a workshop in London? And the non-Brits go, oh, London, cool. And most Brits go, oh, not London, because it's so full of tourists and everything. So we're probably going to do one in right outside of London. We're looking at doing a workshop in Liverpool. So that will be around a nice area with the docks and people. And so we'll do some urban photography there. And yes, Beatmaster, the Germans are coming. And then we will, I'm looking into a third one possibly, probably in the southwestern area, Cardiff or something in this area. So we're looking at possibly three workshops. Still in the planning, but we are going to... I'm going to come to the UK, and I'm already working on some of this thing. Wow. Good to hear. Oh, Web89. What are, if any, plans? What plans do you have for future app updates? So you are most likely referring to the Pocket Chris app. Tony, can you give me the over the shoulder? So here's Pocket Chris. This way. Okay. So, as you can see on the top row here, there are four Pocket Chris's. The one is Pocket Chris, the free version, so that'll give you some photo information. The second one is an advanced one. The third one is another advanced one. And then these first three have been released. Here's number four. And number four is called Creative Boost, and it has 18 topics in it from... And it's not finished yet, so you're looking at a beta version here. It pretty much has an entire bunch of let me see. Let me just bring up one here. And again, here, placeholder. So there's still picture material to go in there. But it's pretty much a series of little lessons that you can work through and get some creative input, get to work on your creative side, because that is really the key to a lot of these, a lot of good photos is not the gear. It's not the big gun telephoto lens that costs $2,000. It is the creative side. That's what makes your pictures. So Pocket Chris will come out with another one. And I've added a little plug thing here. Look, pull it up and Chris moves down. And there's pretty much different ways to get in contact. It has a list of workshops in here. Has all sorts of stuff in here, how to reach the show, how to send feedback to the show, my public calendar. So I'm putting all this in here to kind of give everyone an opportunity to talk to me, contact me, and then there's some more information here when you tap on Chris. So if you haven't looked at Pocket Chris yet, if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, this is an iPhone app. It will run on the iPad, but it's not fully compatible, so you will have to run it in like double size mode, and you can just try it out. It's a little teacher in your pocket. It's this little you know, there are all these photo apps out there that do filtering and that do all these cool things to pictures, and like Instagram and Hipstamatic and all these camera apps out there. And what I missed in the App Store was the teaching aspect, and that's what I'm about. So that's how Pocket Chris came to be. And check it out. The first one's free, and the other ones are like $199. So they're not going to make you poor. And the fourth one is almost ready. So as you saw, there are just some placeholder pictures that need to be replaced. The content is done. So I think pretty shortly after I'm back from this North American tour, I'm going to release that, and hopefully people will like it. Good question. Several times on the chat, are you going to make a Pocket Chris for Android? At this point, no. I would love to be able to do that, but it's very hard. Pocket Chris lives by the experience, and it has a lot to do with the timings and with the sizes of the screens, and everything has to fit really well. And believe it or not, I'm not making a lot of money with Pocket Chris. So if it was like a huge, big, successful app that was always in the top 20, which it isn't, I would go for Android as the next market. But at this point, it's just not feasible. Unless someone wants to do it for free. I'm happy to work with anyone who wants to spend the time and make something that works on as many Android devices as possible. But I've just recently seen this picture of someone, a company developing for Android, and they had an entire table, like this table I'm sitting at right now, full with like 50 different Android devices that they have to test on and to make sure it runs everywhere. And I just can't do this. There's no way I can afford doing that. Okay, last two questions. Web2886, you mentioned that you recommended shooting RAW. I have just started shooting RAW versus JPEG. I'm currently using Canon's DPP. What do you think of that software, and what do you use? So DPP is a RAW processor. It takes your pictures from its digital photo processor. I don't know what the DPP, I think that's what it stands for. I use Lightroom. That's my software of choice. Lightroom is made by Adobe, and it is it's a RAW processor. It also takes JPEGs, and it makes things a bit simpler. The DPP is good. It knows all the Canon specifics, but it's a bit slow to work with. So I just found that Lightroom works for me really well. Oh yeah, Digital Photo Professional. And it's, yeah, as DLR says, it's quite good but different to use, yes. So Okay, last question. Do we have anything over here? Oh, where's my mouse? Here it is. Are you doing anything in Spain? Nice Picks for You asked that question. No, not at this point. And I have to be careful not to spread myself too thin, because it's not just a matter of going there and doing a workshop. It's also a matter of getting it organized. So I'd have to have someone local to help me with organization. And then I'd have to to convince people to come with me there, which is not always that easy. So it would have to be a very easy-to-reach location. Price for accommodation is always an issue. So setting up a workshop outside of Germany is actually always a very huge endeavor. It looks easier than it is. So I'm trying to concentrate on a few locations. So this year, again, I was in Washington, D.C. I did a workshop there. 2 days, one day of shooting, one day of post-processing. We actually did Lightroom there at my friend Shaquille's place. He's got a training company called Secure Ninja. And it's in Washington, and he's like, it's got these computer rooms, and so I could use one of those, which was really awesome. And then next is Toronto, so I'll fly out to Toronto on Monday and gonna hold two workshops there together with Sean Galbraith, who's been saying funny things on the chat for the last hour. So we'll be doing one large format photography workshop, film-based. We'll do one urban photography workshop, digital-based, which still has a few spots open. So still happy to get some new participants on that. And then I'll be traveling to Canyonlands National Park. So there will be a three-day photo workshop, landscape adventure kind of thing. So we have seven photographers there, and we'll be camping out in Canyonlands National Park for 3 days, and get up early, get the good light, and hopefully shoot cool pictures. And William Follett, no, you can't buy my tilt shift, not even with a pretty please. You have to pry this out of my hands. No, this is mine, my precious. But check online. Good online used place would be keh.com. I've always had good experience with them. So you can maybe pick one up there for little money. All right. So 10 past. I think we did it. So thanks everyone for hanging in there. Even with a tragic loss of one of our guests. It was a pity. I would have loved to do the tintype photography and talk about that, because it is really an amazing process, and the results are really, really beautiful looking. And they're one of a kind, which makes it more valuable, I think. If you shoot something and you end up with this one thing and not copies of it, it makes it more valuable and it makes it more special, so... Anyway, thank you guys, and I'm going to do something for my voice now. I'm not used to talking 4 hours in a row. So, thanks all, and have a good one.
The photo shoot pictures are not anywhere online, unfortunately.
No, they're not online yet.
But... Well, some of them have been put up. Like people have been putting up pictures on their Facebook page and so forth. But here's the group shots. Let me just show you some of these. Now, you said not to use the
don't use Quick Look. At least on my MacBook Air, it messes up the contrast.
So let me just. I think I can just open these all in preview.
You should be able to just put them in preview. Yes,
that would be the best way to do that.
So what I've done is
can you see my
2 days ago, I was here to do group shots.
And these are great.
We ended up having a ton of fun.
So this is all of us reading the Diamond Club. we were looking for pictures of the staff. Now, unfortunately, there's no time when everybody's here. In this case, Tom Merritt was on vacation.
That's too bad. We should Photoshop him.
Who else is missing? Do we know?
Just
Just Tom? Really? Just Tom. That's pretty good. And these are all the people who are in studio, obviously, not Burke. Look at Burke. Everybody's reading the book except Burke. He's just looking at the camera. You know, it's funny because we can never really get Burke to do that when we're actually taking pictures. This is the first time I've ever seen Burke not be hiding.
Oh, he doesn't?
No. This is hysterical.
Well, he was hiding in some of the other group shots.
Yeah.
So,
like, isn't this funny? This is a great shot.
Now, try to imagine having done such a group shot in the cottage.
Oh, I love this. Wait a minute.
Yeah, Sarah was standing in for more focus checking, and I just liked the
way
she...
That's cute. She is adorable.
She gave me this deer in the headlight look.
Oh, now everybody's supposed to be pointing at me, but I...
They're covering up each other's faces. That's the problem with group shots, you know? You end up being...
Isn't this cute? These are great. Oh, Chris, I am so grateful that you did this.
We made everyone have something Twit-related in their hands, so there are lots of props.
Yeah, they're all holding something. I've got my dog and my crown. Can't see Lisa in that one. She's hidden.
Lisa's hidden. There's the other one where Lisa... I think it's probably the next one. No, not, yes, that one. That one is it. Zoom in on Lisa.
Which one?
Go one back. Go one back.
Going back?
Go back one. No. Further down. No, it's one of the red ones. Keep going.
That's a cute one.
Keep going. One more.
There we go. Zoom in on Lisa. This is a good one of Lisa and Burke.
I totally love that.
This is a great. These are great. These came. Chris does a workshop on group photography.
We do group photography is part of every workshop because you want to have fun and you want to give people something.
That's hysterical.
A memento. So these things are all about timing. These are all about hitting that.
This is a great shot. Right. Look at Alex. Everybody's so interesting in this shot.
Yeah.
Look at Brian.
Skeptical.
Josh. This is a great shot.
Let's get the eyes closed. But we could probably clone them from another
shot. We can
shot.
Clone Jeff.
We could clone them
good
from
picture of
shot.
Tony. Tony, you look good in that picture. Tony, you've been looking really sharp lately.
You know what the real problem was with these shots?
What?
Chad's hair.
It was too bright?
Red channel.
Yeah.
Camera, the digital camera with its RGB channel. The red channel
it's getting
is
confused.
Always... Easier. This is the easiest one to blow out, the easiest one to overexpose.
God, I have a good-looking staff, don't I? Except for Greg. No, I really do. Everybody looks so good. Look at this.
Oh, this is the
This is Michaela. We're doing Michaela is Not Impressed.
Uh-huh.
Which you don't know what that is, because in the U.S. it was a kind of a meme. Michaela is one of our gymnasts, and she was on the podium getting her silver medal, and she says the reason she was making the face is because she was... perturbed that it wasn't the Star Spangled Banner that was. I need a different tool. I need a.
All right. So have we started? No, we haven't.
No. We're not starting yet.
Okay. This is.
I want to do more of these. I'm sorry. Oops. I don't know what's going on here.
This is preview not being incorporated.
Yeah, it's not being helpful. I use this all the time in just a couple more. That's the pointing. These are great.
Oh, and these were lots of fun to do. I mean, you guys are a tough bunch to work with. It's really hard to get like attention from everyone.
We're all like distractible.
But it turned out.
What is Chad doing with his tongue? That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah. So we had the. Diamond Club reading session. Oh no! Look at the face. OMG.
Oh, look at that. This is good. This is like hear no evil, see no evil. Mm. Evil.
You have to have this collective.
This is a Canon 5D, and you're using a pretty wide lens. Yeah, the 24.
24 24.
Is it the 24-105?
No, it's the 24 tilt shift.
Oh, it's a tilt shift.
The Mark 1. That's actually what we want to talk about in the first
segment. Oh, I'm so jealous.
Segment.
This is a very expensive lens.
Well, if you get it used like I did, you can get this for about $500 if you're lucky.
Wow, not bad.
But it's super beaten up.
Here's the portraits. Real quick, just go quickly through the portraits here.
Oh, yeah, and there will be multiple ones of some of the people when I thought they were, like, good poses. Use Quick Look. It'll be good.
Really? Quick Look's, yeah, it's a lot faster.
It'll probably,
I'm a little disappointed with...
it'll probably get the contrast a bit too hard, but that should do...
Oh, Karsten, that's great. Hello. Colin. These are pretty. They're kind of... this. I see what you see is about the contrast. It's a little desaturated or something. But it looks good. I like it.
So we had different poses. go back. Go back.
Doesn't seem to be ignoring my keystrokes now.
Go back, do Command A. And now go full screen.
Oh, if I do Command A, I get it.
And now go full screen again.
Let me start over. Okay, now if I do space.
Space.
And full screen.
And now you have this little
four
things icon in the bottom.
Where's my slideshow? There we go.
That's the slideshow. Yeah, so this was simply taken in studio, and I was deliberately putting lights in the background, something that you sometimes want to avoid because they distract
this
from
the subject. Windish. We're going to use
subject.
Yeah, but no, I like this.
But this is
because of depth of field,
and it shows studio.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are like colorful lights in the background, and they give.
We're going to use these for biopics for the website and stuff like that. That's a great shot of you, Tony.
Tough one because the glasses reflect.
But look at the bokeh on the lights. I love the lights. They're just pretty.
These ones were taken with a 51.4.
Ah, it's nice. It's nice. It's really nice. That's Greg Barnett. He doesn't really work here, but there's Glenn Rubenstein. No, I'm just kidding.
Everybody got
a picture.
Everyone
I like
the
catchlight. The catchlight's nice on his eyes.
That's the most important, actually, with portraits.
Yeah.
That's why we actually set up an additional light down here to make sure that everyone has nice catchlights in their eyes because they make it.
That's so cute. He's so cute. He's just adorable.
He's good. He was no.
He was playing along.
He was
and
very,
the
very
beautiful
very
Liz, bouncy girl.
Yeah, she had fun in front of the camera. Way too much
You weren't
fun.
Using a strobe. This is all the light in the studio,
This is all
right?
available light in the studio.
She has a little bit of metal. You wouldn't want to take her through a metal detector.
She probably has issues at the airport.
Oh, my God. That's Lisa and Liz. Aren't they cute? That's great. I like that.
And we had a fan. You see some of the hair flying. So we had
a fan on them. Yeah.
So
these are great.
Those
are great. You can see how much taller Liz is than Lisa, though. It's funny. This is Russell from Exponentia, our IT guy. Aw.
Oh, cute.
Lisa's known Russell since he was, 19, 18? Years and years. Oh, look at Chad. He looks demented.
And the hair flying because of the fan.
Oh, these are great. These are great.
There's one that is going to be... No, not this one. I think it's the next one.
He had just had his hair... Just got his hair done, so it's good.
This one.
He's doing Blue Steel. Tony, I love that. What a good idea.
Mr. Racer Man.
He rides his bike here.
And another helmet here.
Yeah. John, that's a great picture of John. You're a good photographer. I really like these.
Thank you.
You got his personality there.
I like...
These are really personal.
The thing with portraits is that you don't want to shoot when people are posing. You want to shoot.
Yeah, see, this
poses.
Is what's wrong with all the pictures you took of me.
I mean, okay,
I was posing for you.
No, we were trying this lascivious thing.
Right.
You know,
it wasn't a good look. These are just creepy.
Yeah, but you really don't want to shoot, especially
wide
people
angle.
Who are not used to standing in front of the camera. You don't want to shoot when they pose. You want to shoot between the poses.
Right.
You want to get them. You want to trip them. In some way, and then they go, ha-ha, and they get
right.
They become themselves.
See,
that's
these are great pictures of Lisa, because she's not paying attention to the fact that they're getting pictures taken.
Well, and you are just way too
and I'm just way too being over. It's hard to get a good picture of me, actually.
Well,
that's good, Alex. I like these. You look great.
Well, after this photo day, cute. I have a photo session planned with Lisa.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
You going to do nude shots?
Want some good? No.
You do a little boudoir photography?
Look into that.
She says no. That's no. cute. Look at that. The married couple. That's great. They're very serious. She's not so happy. She smelled something. Oh, I like that. Very nice picture. I don't know who it is, but it's good. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Damn, these guys are good looking. I know. I have all these good looking people. Oh, gee. It's a nice picture, Ozzy. Did you process these at all?
A bit of white balance and a bit of contrast.